meeting to order. We do not have a quorum at this point, so we will start without a quorum, and as soon as we have one, we will officially call the meeting to order, and we will do some, we'll get the minutes passed and some things like that. Today, what we have on our calendar is we have the House File 2384. It's a school employee health insurance pool bill. The agenda for today will be the time. As you know, the Commerce Chair doesn't like time limits. We like to have a full and fair and free debate, but this is an issue that we could spend as much time as on moisture intrusion, but we're not going to. We are going to set some limits here, and I'll be starting out with a few remarks. Then we'll be going into Mr. John Gross from the Department of Commerce. We'll be given 10 minutes. We will have then 30 minutes for the proponents of the bill. We will then have 30 minutes for the opponents, and I would like you to write down questions that you may have, because we're going to give each side the full 30 minutes. Then after that, what we'll be doing is we'll open up for member questions and amendments. There are several amendments we have here, and we'll work on those. We do have to remove ourselves from this room at 2:15. We'll be coming back. If we're not done, if we haven't voted on the bill, we'll be coming back at 5. So with that, this bill has many, many stops. We set the record last year for most stops for any bill in the history of this great state of Minnesota. And we came up last year with a, or 2 years ago, I guess, we created a group to study how this might work. We have the results of that before us. Members of the committee will be provided with more information as we go along here. As I said, this is the first stop we have. We're looking at education policy, education finance, possibly health policy, health finance, and then state government finance. So we, and government operations. So we have a long ways to go in a short period of time now that the deadlines are set at the 12th of March. So with that, I'd like to make, I will be running the Commerce Committee, even though I'm the author of the bill, I'll be running it from here, and we will have our witnesses, of course, come down to the table. This bill arises out of legislation enacted in 2002, creating a group to study and design a statewide health insurance pool for school employees. This bill would create such a pool, which would be the source of health coverage for all school districts in the state of Minnesota. And if you go down the House bill, House Research Bill summary, you have the definitions. We're creating a board. There would be a board of directors that would oversee this. This would be a, let's just get in the health plan itself. What it does is it requires eligible employees, employers to provide health coverage only through the pool. It's a mandatory pool. The reason for that is if you make it a voluntary pool, you'll have adverse selection and you'll be getting groups that have more health problems, and the ones that could get cheaper someplace else would do that, of course. It gives the board discretion to design the pool as to provide optimal combination of coverage, cost, choice, and stability in the judgment of the board. It provides that the pool may include a choice of health plans and more than one level of premium rates charged to the employers. It does permit geographic variations. It requires claims, reserves, stabilization reserves, reinsurance, and other features to achieve long-term stability and solvency. It permits the board to decide whether the pool should be fully insured, self-insured, or some combination. And it requires the pool to include consumer education, wellness programs, and measures to encourage wise use of health care. It permits the pool to cover Medicare enrollees separately, including providing coverage for supplements to Medicare. And this would start coverages. It requires the pool to begin coverage as of July 1st, 2005. Requires the details of coverage to be available by March 1st, 2005. And the genesis of this bill, the reason that I've been so interested in this bill and working on this bill is because we started to get reports from across the state where there were some school employees that at the end of the month when they go get their paycheck, because they're on a family health plan, they actually owed the school district money. We have situations across the state and testimony over the last couple of years where schools are not even offering health care coverage to the teachers or the school employees within that district. I believe it's time has come to have a statewide health pool for our school teachers, and that's what this bill does. So with that, we do have a group of school teachers here from my old school district. I just assumed that members did not talk to them, but I would like to recognize them. I believe we have some from Kingsland. Are they here yet or now? Or way in the back there, Kingsland. And we have some from Wabasha, Kellogg, Elgin, Millville, Plainview, Rushford, Peterson, and all points in between. So welcome to the committee today, and we're glad you're here. Okay, with that, I will now turn it over to Mr. John Gross. We have a quorum. Okay, we have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting to order. Representative Mallory has read the minutes thoroughly and makes a motion to pass them. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mallory. With that, I will now officially move House File 2384 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Education Policy. With that, I would like to get the bill in the shape that I would like to work from it on so everybody knows what we're working off. The First Amendment is mine. It's a, Mr. Penner, this is the technical amendment, A2.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's right.
Okay. Any discussion on the A2 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Motion passes. Item next is Representative Broad, I believe, has the A3 amendment, and I will move the A3 amendment. What this does, this allows the board to submit a written report to the legislature in compliance with sections. You can read it there. What it does is it provides more information as to what the pool is doing to the legislature. Any discussion on the A3 amendment? I accept this as friendly, but any discussion on it? It would provide more information to the legislature on what this plan is doing and how it's operating and working. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. We now have the bill in the shape that the author would like, and I will turn it over, and we will be keeping a strict, we'll be looking at time very closely here. So with that, Mr. Gross, welcome to committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is John Gross. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Commerce. 2 years ago, Senate File 1755 was passed, which requires a committee to be formed to study the issues of trying to provide health insurance for school districts. There was a 14-member committee. 7 represented the school districts and 7 represented the employees. The committee was to collect and analyze information, determine the feasibility of an insured or self-insured plan, the pooling arrangement, a multi-employer welfare arrangement, to address issues of cost, coverage provided, financial stability, solvency, and management. The committee met from July 2002 until January of 2004. We had about 30 meetings, a lot of good discussion. We hired an actuarial firm called Redden & Anders to do the basically study, and the Department's Employee Relations and Commerce were there to facilitate, to help out the committee and the actuary. There are 341 school districts in Minnesota. They got about a little less than 200,000 employees. And the claim estimate for 2003-04 is around $615 million. And projecting out for 2008-2009, you'll have over $1 billion in claims with the continuing escalating health care costs. The report that Redden & Anderson had provided to the committee was looking at the feasibility and cost of a new pool structure, mandatory pool or a voluntary pool, or just more or less status quo. And based on their rough estimates from the actual firm, if we want to go to a mandatory pool, you can save, in the next 6 years now, you can save approximately $713 million. If you want to go to a voluntary pool, you can save around $638 million. And if you want to have standardized plans, you can save around $585 million. What this will do, obviously, is slow down health care cost escalation, but it's not going to stop that. You're not going to stop that dead in this track. Unfortunately, health care, because of high utilization, higher cost, people living longer, is just a contributing factor. The committee strongly recommended unanimously is 5 standardized plans with a high degree of cost sharing. This is something, again, the committee looked at very favorably. These standardized plans will have an effect of reducing health care costs. The other thing they decided to do was to phase this in, because you might have a school district out there currently that maybe has like low costs, or maybe a school district that has a high benefit set with very little cost sharing. So in the first year, what the committee decided to do was have a similar plan to what the current school district has, and then over time phase it into these standardized plans. The committee agreed, but didn't put it, we did put it in the report, but the committee agreed wholeheartedly that we need to also look at things like disease management, which has a way of reducing health care costs. For example, let's say somebody has diabetes. Let's say your doctor diagnoses you with diabetes and then gives you your prescription for this or that and sends you out the door. What do you do? Maybe it gives you some booklets about disease or diabetes, but what do you do? With disease management, a nurse is going to call you up and basically bug you to death and make sure you do what you're supposed to do. You know, your diet, take your insulin if you have to take your insulin, do your testing, et cetera, et cetera. But this does have proven effect. We also looked at roles, a way of getting the person more involved with their own healthy lifestyles, trying to encourage them to do things in the right manner. Areas we talked about but didn't really come up with any decision, but noting these are problems, is some school districts, because of the state statute, they have to provide, if a teacher retires early, they have to provide coverage until that teacher becomes age 65. That's a state statute. And there was a thought here maybe of offering a separate policy for those retirees. It could have maybe less benefits, more benefits, whatever, but it'd be a separate group. The other thing was talked about was when the person becomes 65, asking them to switch over to a Medicare supplement policy instead of continuing with the current group plan. Again, these are concepts that we talked about. We did take a final vote after our final meeting, which was on January 8th, and 8 committee members voted in favor of the mandatory pool, and that's the bill in front of you. And another group felt that we should just have standardized plans. You will probably hear today from both sides. In essence, this idea of a standardized plans will save some money in the future, and it's just producing more cost sharing for each enrollee. You can stand for any questions or comments you have.
Okay, we have a few minutes left on your schedule, so we will take some questions until 5 minutes to with Mr. Gross here. Rip from Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gross, a couple of just quick questions. Can you review the cost savings under the different scenarios for me again, please?
Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bavin. Again, if you go to a mandatory pool, it's around $713 million you could save. If you go to what's called a voluntary pool, it's around $638 million. And standardized plan is about $585
million. Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Just to clarify, Mr. Gross, over what time period are we looking at these cost savings?
I think we're talking 4 to 6 years.
4 to 6 years.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions at this point for Mr. Gross? Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Gross. The study, if I understand this correctly, laid out maybe 5 different plans. Would everybody have the same costs? All the districts have the same costs? And is there any language in the bill that would ensure that that happens? And I would compare that to the state plan. For example, in my neck of the woods in Elbert Lee, the technical college there, the community college, gets rung up because of the offerings under the state plan. There's not a low-cost provider in our area, so that overage, the employee still pays the same amount, but that overage gets sent right to that institution. Would all institutions buy at the same price, or could a scenario like the statewide the contract we have for state employees happen?
Mr. Gross?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dorman. That was discussed, and I think there was a consensus that that would be more left up to the future, because you could, in a sense, create these let's say 4 or 5 standardized plans, phasing it into one plan. You could have that for the entire state. You could actually have that based on districts. You could break the state down in, let's say, 6 districts, and then it's up to that group and that district what they wanted to have. So we wanted to, what I would consider, to have a high degree of flexibility in the future, how that will be phased in and implemented.
Representative Dorman. Representative Sikora and then Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gross, could you outline for me how you save $700 million over 4 to 6 years, where those savings come from?
Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sikora, basically in cost sharing. A lot of the school districts right now have very little cost sharing.
By cost sharing, you mean that there will be higher co-pays to the teachers or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sikora, exactly. You would have a higher, you would probably have a deductible, you would have a co-pay, and you would have a co-insurance.
Representative
Sikora?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would all, pretty much all districts share in those increased costs or decreased costs, whatever they're going to be, at the same rate, or will there be quite a difference between districts?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Sikora, depending on the district, there could be savings, there could be higher costs. It just depends on what they currently have in their benefit package and what type, obviously what we call cost sharing, and what they're paying currently in premiums.
Representative Sikora?
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gross, on the page 2, line 36 of the bill, it says the pool must include claims reserves. Has there been discussion about what size of these reserves would be required to implement a plan of this size, as far as the size of the reserves?
Mr.
Chairman, Representative Gerlach, the actually estimated around 9-10%. They thought they could be an adequate reserve because this group would be a gigantic mandatory pool, and they thought that would be an adequate amount of reserve. There's been some discussion on that. Is that adequate or not? But the actuary felt it would be.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gross, is that, I don't know if you can compare this exactly to the private sector or industry, but is 9-10% or something, is this sort of an industry standard?
Mr. Gross?
But Mr. Chairman, Representative Gerlach, that I don't know. I know when Dewar did theirs, I think there was like 15%. But our actuary, because of the gigantic size of this group, he strongly felt that 9 or 10% would be adequate.
Okay. Thank you.
Gerlach.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Rukavina?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to go to Representative Wilkin, then we'll come to you. Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gross, many of the suburban districts are likely to see an increase in the numbers that I've seen. Can you kind of discuss that a little bit? Is this for one of the districts would get about a 9% increase. Is that in addition mm-hmm. to normal health care cost inflation? Is that the increase that you'd see in the 1 year? And is it a permanent increase, meaning is it going to go up 9% and then continue to rise, or is it going to go up 9% and then, barring regular medical inflation, it's going to revert back to the normal numbers? Do you understand what I'm getting at here?
Mr. Gross?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, it will go up. I mean, it basically what they actually tried to look at in his projections in one of the exhibits was that he was putting in there a cost trend of like around 5%. But depending on, again, where they are today, it could go up and continue going up because you're phasing them into this new plan that everybody will have.
So, Representative Wilkin.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gross, it's going to go up the 9%. It's going to stay at that level. And this is barring or making the assumption that we're not putting in health care inflation in there. This is a one-time administrative increase that's going to be a permanent 9% increase in their costs.
Mr. Gross?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, if you could identify the school district, I could look up what exactly will happen to them. But
the one in question is 196. I represent two other districts that I don't have the numbers for right off the top of my head. I think they're coming around here maybe, but we'd have to dig for them. But that's the district that is 9, or maybe Representative Gerlach has that number, but 9 or 9.3%. What I'm trying to figure out is if this is all else held constant, assuming that no change in health care costs, is this a 9% increase going to go up just 1 year and it would... Barring healthcare inflation, it would go down the next year. Are we ratcheting everything up 9% from here on to eternity?
Mr. Gross?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, two things. If you could identify by the name of the school district, the numbers I don't know, but the name of the school district.
Rosemont, Apple Valley, Eagan.
Representative Wilkin, to answer your other question, I'd have to look at it, but I would think it just could keep going up. I don't think it's going to go up because we're phasing in over like a 4 or 5 year period, so they're going to go up in increments each year.
Representative Wilkin, we're going to stop there, and Representative Rukavina, when we come back to Mr. Gross, it'll be Wilkin to finish his question, then Rukavina, and then whoever else wants to ask Mr. Gross questions. So if you can stick around, we'll have questions for you after a bit here with Wilkin and then Rukavina. Okay, with that, we're now going to go to Mr. Lee Johansson from Education Minnesota, who is a proponent for the bill, and will be visiting with Education Minnesota and his witnesses until about 1:30. If a page could pass out some information there. Mr. Johansson is from Education Minnesota. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Johansson. If you could please present your testimony on behalf of House File 2384 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lee Johansson. I'm an employee of Education Minnesota, but I come to you today not only as an employee of Education Minnesota, but as the co-chair and chief author of the majority report of the School Employee Health Insurance Study and Plan Design Committee recommendations. I served in that committee with 13 other representatives of schools, equally split between employers and employees, for the last 18 months of gathering data on school district insurance usage, gathering ideas on possible insurance configurations, and doing, in short, a very extensive, exhaustive study of school district insurance. Because, in fact, the school district insurance situation is at crisis level. I oftentimes compare it to a train wreck that has already occurred. The engine has hit the wall. There have been some casualties. There are a few of the cars starting to pile up on the back of them. People are losing their family coverage. They're paying more co-pays. Their insurance costs are being shifted more and more to them. There are still a few people in the club cars, not aware that the crisis is pending, but in fact, if we do nothing, they too will surely pile up against the wall. The report found, after 18 months of study and employing an independent actuary, that a new risk pool to provide health insurance for school districts is feasible. It found that a mandatory statewide pool would be large and stable enough to be structured on a self-funded basis. It found that such a pool, self-funded, would project a savings of $223 million in structural costs during the first 6 years. Structural costs being those costs not associated with the payment of claims, but instead associated with the cost of providing insurance. That equals 4.1% of claims. The savings, if you look in the study, are in fact listed, and I'd be perfectly happy to visit with the committee as far as the specifics of what make up that $223 million in savings. There is also the findings, as well as the report of the entire and the recommendation of the entire committee, the majority committee, 8 members, found that the self-insurance pool for all school employees is in fact desirable, and it is provided for in House File 2384. I'll walk through the provisions of 2384 with you very quickly. In Subdivision 1, we find that eligible employees are defined as those employees who are employed by eligible employers. Eligible employers are public schools in their various varieties, whether they be a public school, a standard independent school district, or whether they be a special ed district or a charter school. All public schools would be eligible employers. It establishes in Subdivision 2, a Minnesota School Employees Insurance Board, which would be a public corporation, which would be empowered to do all of those things necessary to create an insurance pool and to manage that pool on an ongoing basis. This would include contracting for services, employing staff, establishing plan designs, establishing rate structures, and all of those other necessary things in order to continue in the business. It defines the makeup of that insurance board as being made up of 14 members, 7 appointed by the Minnesota School Boards Association, and 7 appointed by those who represent employees. We think that this design is important, but we did improve on it just a little bit from the last time we used it. We do also mandate in the statute that they establish a dispute resolution procedure that could be used, because obviously there will be decisions that must be made, and there's a potential for some law jams to be created when you create a 7-and-7 makeup. But in the end, we believe it's extremely important that those people who have to pay for the product and those people who have to live with the product be put in the same committee to actually balance those interests, to actually have the authority to balance the payment versus the cost. Because until we do that, it's always the at least appearance that one side is attempting to take unfair advantage of the other side. And in creating this balance, we're able to overcome that. The board then would go on to establish the insurance pool, which would be the exclusive provider of insurance for all school employees in the state. It would be the only place where health insurance could be purchased by school employees. We believe that this plan could be in effect and offered on July 1 of 2005, which is provided for in Subdivision 5. The plan would have to be published by March 1 of 2005. And then in Section 2, we ask for a loan from the state to pay for the startup costs. Quite obviously, you have to spend money before you can start drawing in premiums, but we would pay that back to the state with whatever the prevailing interest rates were, so it would be just a return on investment. First, I want to be clear, then, that this is not an unfunded mandate. What we're proposing to do is to spend the money that we're currently spending on insurance and that we are currently obligated to spend on insurance in the future in a more cost-effective manner. Hopefully, putting some check on the runaway cost of insurance. The current system in the year 2003-2004 is costing us over $686 million in premiums. When we use the shorthand of 1 million pupil units, that means we're spending $687 per pupil unit on health insurance. This is the combined contribution of the employer and the employee, $687 per pupil. In the last 5 years, from the year 2000-2001 to the end of the current biennium, next year, the foundation aid formula will have increased a total of $324. At the same time, the cost of employee insurance on a per pupil unit basis will have increased $347. We will have spent $24 more on health insurance per pupil unit than the entire revenue that we've gained from the foundation aid formula. And we will have bought no textbooks, we will have replaced no light bulbs, we will have not put a gallon of gas in the tank of a bus. The current system is simply out of control and has not proven to be cost effective. A reasonable projection of the next 4 years' cost, even if we get an average foundation aid formula increase, an average of the last 5 years, that would equal $65 a pupil unit. We will still lose $70 a pupil unit in the next 4 years if we do nothing. In an average-sized district of 5,000 students, 5,870 pupil units, that means that in the last 5 years we will have lost $110,000 in aggregate. In the next 4 years, we will lose an additional $410,000 in aggregate. For a 9-year insurance cost over new revenue equaling $550,000 in that one school. It cannot be sustained. The current system is unable to grapple with the issues, and we propose to do this business more efficiently, more effectively, and more uniformly. In addition, then, I want to make some things clear about what the bill does not do. What we do is we create a mandatory purchasing pool, but we do not take away local negotiations from the local. The question of who will pay the premiums remains a locally negotiated issue. The question of who is insurance eligible, be it a quarter-time employee, a half-time employee, a three-quarter-time employee, remains a locally negotiated issue. If an individual chooses to enroll in insurance or chooses not to enroll in insurance, remains an individual choice. We do not impose more on the system than simply getting the benefit of large numbers, the economy of scale, and the efficiency of size. Now, there are those who question the study's accuracy. They question the data. What I will say is that we hired an actuarial firm with an elite actuary with over 30 years' experience in the business. The state of Minnesota was the employer, not Education Minnesota. The actuary would get paid whether or not they agreed with Lee Johansson or Education Minnesota. The actuary's reputation and the reputation of his firm dictate that they would come to a conclusion that the numbers took them to, not what my desires were. And with that said, I'd point out that after 18 months of study, 12 months with the actuary crunching numbers, coming to the conclusion that a 9.8% reserve, for instance, is adequate, coming to the conclusion that we could save $223 million in structural costs, is pretty easy. It's pretty easy for somebody to sit on the outside and throw stones at the report. It's pretty easy to say, I don't know if that number is large enough. But at some point, we have to trust the expert. We have to trust the study. The numbers are what they are. But if they aren't, the board that we create is responsible for making certain that they maintain a solvent operation and is empowered to make adjustments in those numbers as they see fit. Now I'd like to just touch on one last item before I wind it up, and that is much has been said of winners and losers. And most of the information that comes from winners and losers is drawn from an exhibit number 20.4. 20.4 is the exhibit that was being referred to when Mr. Gross was testifying. It lists the individual districts, and then it lists some numbers. I want to read from the instructions for understanding Exhibit 20.4. Number one, the exhibit is intended only to illustrate how transition ratings might work. It is not intended for any other use. The last sentence of instruction number one says, while the exhibit produces good projections as a whole, it is not designed to be an exact district-by-district basis, to predict costs on an exact district-by-district basis. Now, I would be happy to visit with the committee about the proper interpretation of that report, but ultimately it is not a report that can be used to identify what any one district will experience over the years of transition. With that said, I would like to leave with the following 4 points. A statewide insurance pool will have structural cost savings, non-claim savings, that the projection is $223 million. In addition to that, there are plan design savings depending on what plan a district chooses. Secondly, a district pool of 200,000 insured lives, which is what this pool would be, and to give you a point of comparison, the state employees pool is about 70,000 lives. So a pool of 200,000 lives would in fact be large and stable, and because members can't opt in and opt out, the rate stability evens out. And we get manageable premium increases consistent with medical cost trend rather than spikes depending on individual, local, and district usage. Third, a pool this size gives us position in the marketplace. Much is said about market forces in today's discussion about just about everything, and I'd point out that the medical marketplace on a micro level, at that level where you and I are with our doctors, that medical marketplace is a totally dysfunctional marketplace. It's the only place that we would spend over $600 million a year, and neither the buyer nor the seller knows what the cost of the product is. That marketplace doesn't work as it's currently configured. But on the macro level, on the level where the insurance pool deals with the pharmaceutical companies, for instance, at that point, the laws of the marketplace do come into play. At that point, discounts and rebates can be bargained more successfully, and we know that the laws of scale and size apply. And then finally, we gain data. The one thing we all know is we're not ever going to get a handle on medical cost increases until we start to look at the utilization side of the ledger. And when we get a database with 200,000 people in it, we can then start to identify trends and factors that you can't identify when all of this data is disaggregated and spread around 341 districts. For instance, we learned in the study that school employees in Minnesota have a higher than normal being the Minnesota average, incidence of skeletal muscular disorders. Now, we didn't know that before. But once we have that data, we can go to employers and we can say, is there something about the way we do the job that we can adjust in order to address this issue? And we can also then go to our members, our employees, and we can actually provide meaningful information on things that they can do to work on their back problems. And then the wellness program is no longer just a Disease of the Month Club newsletter that goes out and people ignore, but in fact is a meaningful piece of information that allows people to adjust and modify their behaviors so that in fact we can begin to get control of that utilization size. That is a benefit of a pool this size. We encourage your support for this. We believe that what we see in the report is only the beginning. Where we have the potential to go over time is really an exciting proposition, and we urge your support for House File 2384. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I'll be taking names for questions for Mr. Johansson, but we have someone
with us that's driven quite a ways. We're going to hear your testimony, and then when we open up for member questions, hopefully you can stick around, and then we can get some questions to you. Okay, yes, Representative Rukavina.
From my legislative district. She's come down from the Saudi School District, but and she's going to tell us, I think, a very, very interesting story that may or may not, in my opinion, give cause to support this bill, but I think she's in support of this bill and the concept of it, as we all are, including you, Mr. Chairman. My question is for Mr. Johansson, while Ms. Lefkula is sitting next to him, so am I going to have that opportunity, or are they going to disperse and I won't have the opportunity to ask the question?
As you're the lead DFLer on this committee, I'm going to show you some latitude. Go ahead and ask.
Mr. Johansson, sitting next to you is Sila Lattila from Mesabi East, who you probably know quite well, who's probably maybe next to Mr. Gross in this room, knows more about trying to control medical costs than anybody in the room. And if I'm not mistaken, Sila, in 86 or 85, the Mesabi East teachers then Roy Lake School District walked a picket line, particularly over medical insurance. Okay. And so, Mr. Johansson, now you want a statewide pool. You don't want a statewide bargaining unit, which I would support. You all walk, you go for the same things, you all get the same benefits. But Ms. Lefkula and her peers at the school walked a picket line, fighting for medical benefits, and I'm sure giving up other benefits in the bargaining process. So, Mr. Johansson, I can't find 20.3 in this 400-page document, or 20.4, I can only find it 20.3. I don't know what's going to happen to Ms. Lefkula and her colleagues at Mesabi East. I just want you to look her in the eye, tell her she's going to get as good, if not better, benefits than she's getting now, and pay less, because that's the promise that we've heard from you. And my job as State Representative, District 5A, Mr. Chair, is to protect the people that send me down here in District 5A. And I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't a good deal for them. But if you can sit here today at this table after your little spiel, and you can look Celia in the eye and tell her that she's going to get better benefits, pay less, and all those retirees that they pay for Mesabi's are going to be taken care of, and that they're not going to be in the same boat a year or two from now, I'll support your bill. So can you do me that favor, Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Johansson, careful now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, if I turn and look Scylla in the eye, I wouldn't be looking you in the eye, and I'd like very much to be looking you in the eye as I answer your question.
Don't worry about my insurance.
What I do know is this. What I do know is this, that the system that we have currently in place is stressed to the point of breaking, and that, in fact, if we do nothing, the good people in East Mesaba will not have the insurance package that they have today within, I would guess, a few short years, certainly within 5 years. The pressure on the system is such that to position ourselves with the false hope of keeping what we have versus moving on to something that's somewhat unknown and scary is, I think, just that, a false hope. And while I cannot promise her that she will have something better than she has today, I can say with near certainty that if we move here, she will have more security, she will have more coverage, she will have the best price, much more so than if we just let this thing run its course and let that train engine and all of the cars pile up on the wall behind them.
Okay. With that, I do want to hear from the witness that's driven down from Mesaba East. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and then provide us with your testimony.
Chairman David, my name is Sheila Latola. I'm from Mesaba East, District 2711, located in Aurora, Minnesota, in the heart of Iron Range. We have been a self-funded pool since 1980. And since he alluded to our strike, which was in 1989-90, and the reason was we wanted to form a health committee, a health fund, and that's what it was over, because we wanted direct input into what constituted our health costs. So our district has been pooling for a long time, and for the last 14 years, all of the bargaining units at Mesaba East have been a part of this health committee. A part of the health committee in that we all have it in our contracts that no changes can be made unilaterally. It goes to the committee, goes back to the bargaining units, and then comes back to the committee, and the majority votes. But what we have done is we have done everything that we can do to control the costs. We are truly a pool. We have spent years educating our people, not educating them just to be wise consumers, but educating them to the fact that there's only one pot of money. There's only one pot of money that can be spent at the school. And out of that pot of money, we have to educate the children, feed them, put gas in the buses, do all of those things, pay my salary, and provide health insurance. That has taken a great deal of effort on our part. But everyone has bought into the fact, and they understand. So it makes controlling our health costs actually quite simple. Everything that we've done is we designed our own plan. We have deductibles. Everyone pays. I know Representative Brookavina and I talked about this just right prior to the committee, that everyone pays part of the premium. Everyone pays 10% of the premium. We do have a large number of retirees till age 65. That are covered. We are able to do this. We have sustained our costs. The one area that we have absolutely no control over at all is our reinsurance. We only have 260 people or contracts in our district. That's remained steady for the last 5 years, 260, which translates to about 490 people. Yet we are able to sustain only increases of, well, between 5 and 9%. This year, our renewal rate is coming in at about 2%. And why is because our reinsurance costs are going up. We have absolutely no control over that. Everything else, we have stabilized our usage because our people understand that it's usage that drives the cost. Do we buy in 100% to the state plan? Well, it is an option for us, but it becomes a real option because 5 years ago our budget was a little over $11 million and our health costs were 12% of that. Today, our budget is only $7 million and we come in at about 22% of that cost is for our health. 5 years down the road, what is it going to be? We have done everything that we can do. We are conscientious users. There isn't an employee in our district that doesn't understand our health fund. They don't just pay the premium and then forget about it. They have monthly updates on what's in the reserves, what's been paid out. They understand when the renewal process comes, what all of the figures mean. We are very actively involved, not just the teachers, all of the employees of our district. This is something that we have all bought into. Our fear becomes, in 5 years, can we sustain when our total budget is going down and the things that we have no control over the cost of medical services, the cost of reinsurance. We can't up our reinsurance anymore. Our reinsurance right now, our stop loss, is at $40,000. To us, that puts us at a great risk. We do not have a large pool. 260 contracts, that's all that we have. We can't afford to raise that any higher. But yet we pay $400,000 a year for that stop loss insurance. That's out of our control. Everything that we have control over, we have taken action. And we are very conscious of it. I'm very well informed on the state health pool. Do I support it? Yes, I support it. Does our district support it? Yes, we support it. From the aspect of where else will we go? What will we do? We know what all of our figures. I can tell you our figures from 1980 until right till today and what our trends are and where we're going. But we only have to look at that pot of money and what we're putting out and how long can we sustain that. Can we do that for another 5 years and still educate our children? The other aspect is that we're educators, or I'm an educator, and everyone else in our district that's involved in this deal with education. I'm not an insurance person. That's outside of my realm of expertise. But we've become knowledgeable, but certainly not experts in it. We manage, we do well, we know where our dollars are going. But can we continue? So I think that this is not a Minnesota problem, this is a national problem. But we need to do something. So we support Post File 23.
54. And I'm glad you do. Thank you. Thank you so much. Now, Mr. Johansson will be here when we start up again at 5, so I'd like to defer questions, but I certainly don't want to ask the witness that's from Mesaba East to have to stay. So if there are some questions at this point, we've got about 5 minutes for questions, then we'll go into the other side, and then at 2 o'clock we'll open up for questions, so you may be called down for some more questions at that point. I have Rukamina Gerlach Johnson for Mr. Johansson. I'm going to defer, but for Ms. Latola, any questions for Ms. Latola at this point? Thank you. Thanks so much for coming down to testify on this bill. We will take about 5 minutes now for questions for Mr. Johansson, and we'll go until 1:30. Then after that, we'll have the opponents make their presentation. Okay, Representative Rukovina, to Mr. Johansson, or were you finished with the last question?
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Johansson, after hearing Ms. Letala's testimony, you know, one of the things she talked about, and she, I will say they've done an excellent job there with their small self-insured pool and educating their employees and members on the, you know, on what it really costs for health insurance. But one of the problems, I think, Seal alluded to it, is the fact that district with declining enrollment such as theirs, and a lot of ours in rural Minnesota, where revenues because of declining enrollment and other things that have happened around here have dropped from $11 to $7 million, and of course costs for insurance have risen from 11% to 22% of the budget. How do you address that? I mean, what's going to happen to districts with declining enrollment but still have to have a certain number of teachers, the bus drivers, cooks, etc., that's going to not bankrupt those districts anyhow?
Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, all of those problems are very real problems. They're very real problems for districts in your area and probably in just about everybody else's area. What we know is that insurance is one of the most rapidly escalating components of those that are driving those costs up, that are putting all sorts of pressure on the foundation aid formula and school finance. We believe that the study shows and the projections show that, in fact, we can do that more efficiently and we can rein in the escalation of costs. But we do not believe that school district insurance is a silver bullet that will somehow fix the entire funding mechanism for schools, because that is an underlying serious problem. But that's something that the insurance situation cannot and will not resolve. It's only a part of it. We believe that this slows down the rate of growth. This makes that component more manageable. It allows us to get some breathing room. But ultimately, there's a larger problem than just insurance.
Representative Rukavina. Okay, with that, we will now go to the opponents of the chairman's bill, who will, of course, get the same time and fair treatment that the proponents received. But we have quite a few on the list, so I'm just going to start at the top of the list and go down. So I hope that as you testify, you will realize that there are others that wish to testify. If we run out of time, as I said before, members and people wish to testify against the bill, this has many stops. So what I would do is if we do not get to certain folks, they would be in the next committee the first on the list to get their point on the record. So we'll just start at the top with Ms. Grace Schwab from the Minnesota School Board Association. If you could please give us your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I don't know if I like my seat. I think this might be the first time I've actually testified against the chairman's bill, so I realize how delicate that is. First of all, our School Boards Association has a long-standing policy that really is against statewide bargaining, period, or regional bargaining. We really feel our local boards do the best jobs for each individual circumstance, for our teachers as well as for price. But let's take a look at this bill. This bill doesn't have a plan or a plan design. There are no costs or cost projections for districts across the state. But it does do one thing. It creates a new layer of bureaucracy. We've studied this issue four times, members. We have our newest report said it might have savings if the plan strips away the MENCHA tax and shifts those burdens to small employers and shifts a greater portion of the plan cost to the employees. All the numbers in this report have virtually never stayed the same. They've changed from version to version and contradicted themselves back and forth. I believe this new report has fatal financial flaws. Another report found that a statewide teacher health insurance would cost more money. And two other reports didn't think a statewide insurance pool would have any effect at all. Schools aren't alone in experiencing health care train wreck costs. Farmers, grocers, tire store owners have all seen rising health care costs. Members, this bill is not a magic bullet. But it does open the state up for a statewide strike and puts every school district in the state on the hook to reestablish and guarantee the plan
Members, this cure is worse than the disease. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Schwab. We'll now go to Mr. Paul Brinkman, and if the testifiers against could please stick around and hopefully come tonight, because there'll be questions for members for both sides here. Mr. Paul Brinkman, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir. And welcome to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Chairman Davids, members of the committee. Thanks you for the opportunity to talk here today. I've got three items I'd like to enter into the record for the committee, Chairman.
Certainly, if the page could pencil out to members.
First item is a report from the Wall Street Journal dated September 29, 2003. Second item is a brief summary about the Minnesota Service Cooperatives that we want to share with you this morning. And the third item this morning, yes, sir, is an article dated May 15, 2003, which outlines one documented failure of a giant mandatory statewide pool. My name is Paul Brinkman. I live in Virginia, work in Mountain Iron. I'm currently serving as executive director of the Northeast Service Cooperative. My background, part of the reason I'm here today, is prior to being named executive director of the Northeast Service Cooperative, I worked for over 9 years in healthcare administration. I'm past president of the Minnesota School Boards Association, where I was on the Board of Education for the Virginia Public Schools. And most recently, I've been named to the Board of Directors at Virginia Regional Medical Center. What I'd like to open with, Chairman Davids and members of the committee, is the article that's coming around from the Wall Street Journal, dated September 29, 2003. We read the report. And frankly, to be candid, I think the report helps the debate, because it is an important debate for all of us here in the state of Minnesota. What I found interesting in reading the report is so many things in the report that are mentioned as best practice are currently part of what we do at the Northeast Service Cooperative and among the Minnesota Service Cooperatives. For example, on page 12 of the report, top of the page, it says, current disease management strategies are working. In fact, there's no way to improve upon them in the current marketplace. In the September article from the Wall Street Journal, towards the end, it mentions that a current program around disease management is run by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota and American Healthways, based in Nashville, Tennessee. It's one of the best out there, nationally recognized. Currently, that national program, top in its class, is available as part of the premium paid for members of the Minnesota Service Cooperatives. We do things quietly. We do things well, and frankly, there's areas where we can improve, and that's part of the outline that we have in page 2 that we sent around the room here a moment ago. If I may take 4 or 5 minutes just briefly to talk about us, because there's a number of groups today that are going to come in opposition to the particular study that's on the table and the legislation, but I think as background, it might be helpful for you, and we've had some questions. What do you do? What are you all about? Turn your attention to the one-page summary about the Minnesota Service Cooperatives. We are established in legislation set up by you in Minnesota Statute 123A21. We are governed by elected officials with, under statute, independent school district elected officials in the majority of our elected representative regional board. We serve both independent school districts and cities, counties, and other governmental authorities within 9 regional boundaries, roughly as you would expect those regional boundaries. We have a Metro EXU, as it's called, one of the 9 service cooperatives. We're in the northeast part of the state, and there's 7 others around the state of Minnesota. If you profile us, what we're doing currently in the marketplace, 7 of the 9 service cooperatives coordinate insurance services together. School districts and cities, counties, and other governmentals coordinate regionally under joint powers authority. We are unique in that we're self-funded at the regional level, fully funded at the local school district level. What does this mean? There is no risk for an independent school district in our pool, and currently no risk to the state of Minnesota. The service cooperatives are structured to absorb the risk. We serve about 311 school districts, representing approximately 47,000 member contracts. Some of the advantages of the service cooperative membership model, first of all, we're structured but voluntary. What do we mean by structured? We have board authority, joint powers authority, a master agreement, currently with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. We go out under RFP every 5 years or better. We have strategic agreements in place, such as the ones referenced in the Wall Street Journal article, and we have advisory direction, including labor management participation. But we are also voluntary. were organized around quality improvement, member involvement, and accountability. What does this mean? Well, one of the quality improvement components would be around stop loss. In other words, annually, whether we're being reviewed by the legislature or not, annually we look at our business strategy and the products and services that we're offering and tweak them. Why do we do this? First of all, our members are holding us accountable. We are governed by our own members, and we operate transparently with the data information that's shared. In fact, we have the ultimate accountability in that if we don't work for you, you vote with your feet and you leave. We're strengthened currently by a partnership with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota under a master agreement for the 7 of 9 service cooperatives mentioned earlier. We're secured through sound insurance practice, including rate stabilization reserves, which have been discussed in the report. As mentioned a moment ago, we are self-funded with independent school districts and the state of Minnesota held harmless. We're coordinated statewide, but rated and evaluated regionally. Now you start hearing pieces of what you've read in the report, things that we are already doing as part of our service cooperative model and work well. We're focused on effective plan designs, including consumer-directed health care plans. I'm under one. Went to a consumer-directed health plan September 1, 2003. It changed the conversations between my wife and I on what we're doing with our health care dollars, how we seek care, and what we want to do long term. It's been an interesting journey, but we wanted to make sure we modeled what we said we wanted to practice in the marketplace. We also have managed care for prescription drugs, disease management, and wellness benefits. In fact, when you look at all of the above bullet points, we're really the plan of choice currently, including lower structural costs. PEEP is at 12.9%, moving downward. CGIP at 9.9%, audited recently, moving downward. The Minnesota Service Cooperative's current year were at 7%, looking for a 6% structural cost in 2004-2005. We have challenges, including local control. As much as we love local control, I've been part of that. We challenge our members more than we have in the last 2 years around best practice, such as cash in lieu. In fact, member education has been the heart of what we've done the last 12 to 18 months, and that includes labor management visits site by site. Many of them upon invitation. We've been at Mesabi East, for example. They're not in our pool. They invited us. We talked with them. They said, are you sure you want to come over? We said, sure. Doesn't matter whether you're in our pool or not. We're here to help you because of that member relationship, the way we're structured. And we're currently implementing consumer-directed health plans around the state and trying to model them in our region by the Northeast Service Cooperative as an employer going to a consumer-directed health plan, of which I'm part. Some of the opportunities we see is to continue to encourage best practices, many of them highlighted in the report, and a number of them already part of what we do. In other words, challenging bad practice around adverse selection, such as cash in lieu and multiple plan designs. We analyze data and trends on an annual basis. We are not a status cooperation. If the legislature wasn't reviewing us, we would have to continually improve anyway. Why? Because our members can vote with their feet. They can leave us if we aren't doing the job. And finally, we are marketing consumer-directed high-deductible health plans, such as the VIBA plans available for the cooperative. The Minnesota Service Cooperatives have a history of service since 1976, targeting and addressing the issues, many of them, raised in the study. We're happy to serve you. Glad to be here today. We have other handouts for you. You can review in your own time. But again, thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to be with you this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Brinkman. I would ask on the list of people that are here to testify in opposition of the bill, is there anyone that has traveled from some distance that would not be able to come back, possibly some other meetings? Okay, with that, we'll have Mr. Bob Johnson and Dominic Spazzetto to present their material. And again, members, we're not going to be asking questions. We want to get as much of this testimony in the record as we can. And for some of those of you that might not be able to, if you have any written statements, we will certainly pass those out to the committee and put those in the record. If you could please identify yourselves for the record and provide your testimony, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dominic Spazzetto. I'm here representing the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform.
And Bob Johnson with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, if you please the chair, I think I'll go first and then turn it over to Mr. Johnson. The group I represent, the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform, is an organization of three insurance agents associations in Minnesota, representing some 9,000 insurance agents and brokers throughout the state. First, let me say that most of those agents and brokers do not write insurance for school districts. There are a few, but it's a fairly specialized field. Our overall concern, though, is with the direction of this legislation and what it could mean for small businesses, which are those entities that are written by most of these insurance agents, and what the impact would be upon those small businesses by this legislation. My first item of concern is the recommendation from the study and the suggestion in the legislation that this large pool self-insure. And in fact, the majority of savings that are envisioned in this program come from the self-insured mechanism. And by self-insuring, the plan would be able to avoid both MSHA assessments, our Comprehensive Health Association, and the premium tax, which we levy on all the other domestic insurers. And without that funding, taking that funding out of the pie means that that would be transferred to everyone else that still writes business in the insurance marketplace. Second issue is that the state legislature continually looks at health care insurance in Minnesota and over the years has stipulated many requirements for our insurers. Many of the mandated benefits in statute are originated by the legislature. Another feature of self-insurance is to avoid those particular types of mandated benefits. And the outcome of that is it encourages more and more people to self-insure. So we now have most large insurers in the state, those that write over 50 employees or more, are all self-insured now, or the majority of them are. The state employees plan now is self-insured, and if we take the teachers and self-insure it, we're creating a critical mass that trickles down to all of those small businesses that continue to insure themselves in the private marketplace, and it makes it more and more difficult for them to continue to do so. Another issue of concern is the area of reserves. The report suggests a level of reserves that we think is inadequate, especially given the type of program of this nature in the first several years. We think the reserves may be inadequate, and what happens if they are? And no one can really tell you if they are or they aren't. We'll just have to wait and see how it goes, depending on utilization of the plan. But if they are inadequate, what happens? It falls onto the local school district. The local school district has to do something, and I will probably suggest that they will come back to the state legislature and ask for assistance from the state legislature, since the state legislature is the entity that's enacting this particular legislation. So somewhere along the line, I think the state could be on the hook. Finally, Mr. Chairman, let me say that agents believe that there is a crisis in health care insurance. It's being shared by everyone in the marketplace, small businesses, large businesses, and the state. We believe that competition and freedom to choose various plans and options are the best way to deal with this in this particular marketplace. And this legislation does not do that, and therefore we are opposed to it. Thank you,
Mr. Spazzello. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'll just even more briefly endorse Mr. Spazzello's comments, and from the companies that I represent perspective, we agree. So I'll not repeat that, but I find it ironic that I actually come to ask that the state health insurance laws be applicable to Minnesotans, and we're not doing that. And actually, we ought to be, I think, more candid in the recognition and the acceptance, and maybe we're reaching the point in time where we ought to think about repealing Chapter 62A and those related provisions that apply to solvency, financial regulation, CPA audits, regulation of investments, guarantee funds. We have a whole series of chapters that are consumer protection statutes. They've grown through the years. They're intended to protect Minnesotans, and we all know that they don't apply to most Minnesotans. And frankly, all this does, it grows the pool of people who are not subject to the health insurance statutes of the state. What's Representative Bradley, I believe, testified, 7 out of 10 are not subject. So nothing that's done in here, in this building, affects 7 out of 10 Minnesotans on their health care. And frankly, and maybe we just ought to pick a date and get everybody out from under the application of the health insurance statutes. That actually would be the level playing field then. Then there would be more options in the market, more choices, more competition. I'm not sure what it would look like. I'm not sure who it would be, and I don't think anybody could know that. But I really think we're getting closer to the point where we ought to candidly recognize that people are scrambling to get out from under the costs. AMCHA. We have very good health insurance programs in the state, such as AMCHA. Everybody's going to say that. But the assessment base, it's unfair, it's regressive, it's unstable, and it's not going to keep working. So the day is going to come sooner rather than later where these systems are going to, whether you call it a collapse, they will. They're not going to operate. Because the day's going to come where that limited number of customers in the state who are actually still buying a regulated policy are going to be told that, well, you know, the bad news is that there's a $98 million assessment that we have to levy on the insured market, and you're one of the few still left in that market. It is reaching the absurdity of that. So I don't want to, you know, belabor the point, but that's the truth of the matter. We're just reaching that point. So I think we need to ask the harder questions about the marketplace and who we're going to keep in it at all. Small businesses nationwide are looking to form pools. Now, I'll end with this, Mr. Chairman, is that, frankly, it is worthwhile, and I'd urge the committee to look at the track record of pools. Pools fail. They go down. They fold. They go broke. And it's happened in a number of states. And when they go broke, who's going to pay? We know in the regulated market, if an insurance company goes broke, no consumer suffers. The laws are set up to guarantee that their claims will be paid. Is that true of ERISA plans? No. Absolutely not. And that's just the truth of the matter. So I won't belabor it, Mr. Chairman, but I appreciate the time, and we do oppose the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Okay, I'm not thanking you for opposing the bill, but thank you for your testimony. That was a little Freudian slip there. Okay, with that, Mr. Phil Griffin and Jeff Barsh, if you could please come down. And Mr. Johnson brings up some good points on, you know, when I was first here, I think it was 40% were in ERISA, 60% were not, and now we're at about 70-30 the other way, and at what point does it just go away? And what implications would that have? Okay, welcome to the committee. Was Mr. Stahlberger, did he want to come down too, and why don't you grab a chair there if you would? And
I believe he's right with us.
From the health plans, okay. If you could please state your names and who you represent for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm here representing Preferred One.
My name is Jeff Barsh. I'm here representing Health Partners.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stahlberger with Blue Cross is behind us. He just came in from a meeting out at the headquarters, and we'll all be cutting things short to respect the committee's time.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman, if I can make five quick points. First, the cost of health care has a positive correlation to the services that are consumed and the price of the premium. It's not a surprise that that comes before this committee. It's something that, as Mr. Johnson and Mr. Sposetto said, is happening everywhere to all kinds of businesses. Second, there are cost savings that can be attained through changes in benefit plans, and that is something that can happen outside of the proposal that's before you today in House File 2384. The third thing we would say is that as you look at the report and talks about disease management and moves towards encouraging healthy lifestyles and quality improvement, those are things that health plans are currently doing, and we think we're doing a very good job of. If there is interest in the committee, we'd be happy to show you examples of the kinds of things that are going on. The main point that I'd like to make today is my fourth, which relates to administrative savings, which we don't believe are as great as the report outlines. If, in fact, you want to stop paying MCHA and premium tax assessments, that is not going to be a savings. That will be a shift onto other parts of the marketplace. It is 2% of the 4.1% structural savings that the report talks about. The other 2% comes in areas that we don't believe are as great as they are outlined in the report. And we would particularly point at the issue of risk. If you are going to fund the reserves for these groups, you need to be very, very aware of the fact that you're doing that. And I'll give you a short example. Preferred One started its HMO just 10 years ago. Five members, not the 200,000 that you're talking about putting into this pool. We funded it with $3 million of upfront money, and we were short on what we needed. It cost us $5 million additional dollars in the 3 years that followed to get that plan up and going. That was only 5,000 members. If you're going to 200,000 members, be aware of what happens if you're just 1 or 2% off on the risk when you start building up those reserves. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the policy question remains as to whether or not you want to have benefit negotiations handled as a matter of local control or at the state legislature. That is a policy committee for this committee and the education committee, not one that we are interested in debating on, but we do want you to be aware of those risks and be aware of the fact that we do oppose House File 2384. If there are questions, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you. We're going to defer questions until I want to get as many folks against it to testify as we can here. Mr. Barsh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I won't add much to my colleague's testimony. I will agree that we are here opposing House File 2384. I'll speak just very, very briefly to the actual bill. The bill itself does not create any of the specifics that have been mentioned here, but what it does is give a very, very broad range of authority to a board of directors to create the statewide pool. None of the specifics of that pool or that plan are laid out in the bill, and I caution you about that because development of a statewide teachers pool will have a dramatic effect on the marketplace. And many of the variables that are not addressed in this legislation will have an impact on the marketplace, whether or not that pool is fully or self-insured, what level they do decide to set the reserves at, whether or not they allow many plans or one health plan to offer product in the pool. These are all questions that are not actually addressed. These are just areas of authority that are given to the board of directors. So in addition to the comments addressed by Mr. Griffin, we would add those to a list of concerns. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Stahlberg, you want to make a few comments on the...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, since I'm losing my voice, I'll make my comments brief. Phil Stahlberger from Blue Cross Blue Shield, for the record. I'll deal with the comments of my counterparts, Mr. Griffin and Mr. Bartsch. Also, just want to highlight, I think, Mr. Johnson's testimony that pooling necessarily is not the answer to controlling health care costs, and I think you've heard a little bit about disease management. We feel like disease management does get at the core drivers of health care costs, and we think that is one way we can directly impact the cost of health care. Secondly, since I realize it's not very smart to oppose the chairman's bill, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. With that... With that, we'll bring down Ms. Carolyn Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Carolyn Jones, here today representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I think one of our members, in reaction to this bill, said it best. And he asked a question. He said, why is one segment of the employer market getting preferential treatment through a Band-Aid approach while the overall problem is not being addressed? I think his question is a good one, and one that we should all think about. I want to point out just a few issues, and some of them have been discussed today, but I think it's important that when you really look at the overall plan savings in here, this is just a bill that doesn't incorporate any of that, and that the plan and structural savings could be done right now. We don't need a pool to implement some of the plan design savings that have been suggested. If you look, the structural savings are about 4.1%, and what has been said is that most of that, the 36% of that, comes from the fact that we're not paying our health care taxes. And I don't want to belabor what others have said, but this is a real concern to our members, to small employers who are paying this. Just to put a few numbers to that, in 1997, the MSHA assessment was about $37 million. It's projected to be about $102 million in 2004. So it's rising considerably. And all of that is on a base that's shrinking. In 1997, there were 35% of the market paying that. Today, we have about 30%. With this bill, if you do take the schools out, that's another 6% off of that base. So it creates real problems for that program. But there are other areas that we're getting preferential treatment to this particular employer segment of the market. They assume a $500,000 attachment point. Similar pools where small employers are trying to get together, they've had difficulty even trying to get a $75,000 attachment point approved through the department. Reserve requirements are significantly less than what has been approved for other similar pools for private sector areas. So I think, and was mentioned earlier, some of the 62A provisions. I think we're really circumventing some of the protections that have been put into place. But one of our real concerns about this bill is that it doesn't get at the underlying cost drivers and problems in the system. And we think that real reform is going to come down to purchasers coming together and starting to ask, what are we getting for our health care dollar and what are we going to buy with our health care dollar? And we've started to make progress, and I'm sorry Representative Rukavina is not in the room because I was going to mention a great labor management group that is working on this effort that we have been working with, employers and labor working together to try and see how we can purchase smarter. And I think if we're going to make progress in the market on health care, that we as purchasers have to come together and purchase smarter. And we are making progress on this, but that has to be done in a systematic way, not in a Band-Aid approach.
Thank you. Ms. Gruber from MSHA, and that will probably be it for the folks again. So
the person that doesn't get to testify will be first on our list in the next committee, if we get there. Ms. Gruber, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lynn Gruber, President of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. I have my remarks here if the committee members would like it. It's very brief. Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about MSHA and the impact of this particular bill on our organization. I'll just refer to it as MCHA or MSHA because it's a lot easier to say. But MSHA is Minnesota's high-risk pool for residents who cannot find individual policies of insurance because they have pre-existing conditions and they have been turned down by the private market. We are also considered the HIPAA alternative, and for HCTC, we are the only health plan that's approved to offer health insurance for those folks that are displaced because of a federal trade. So it plays an important part in our state's continuum of health entities. MSHA was created by the legislature in 1976. It became operational in 1977. We have about 34,000 Minnesota residents in the pool now. It's almost nearing its highest point. A lot of that has to do with what I just told you, that we are serving the state as the HCTC health plan and the HIPAA choice, and also just the fact that the economy has not been very good in the past few years. About 60% of our members reside in the greater Minnesota area, 40% out of the Twin City area. MCHA is not a state agency. I think a lot of people think it is. We often get confused with Minnesota Care. We have nothing to do with Minnesota Care. MCHA was created long before Minnesota Care. We are a nonprofit Minnesota corporation. We are not routinely funded by the state of Minnesota. We've been funded twice by the state in our 27-year history. Rather, our revenue is made up of two sources. The first is premium, which is above market. Way that the state has structured our premiums are, as you would imagine, higher than the normal individual market because most of these members that come to us, unless they're dependents, have some serious illness or something for which they were not insurable in the private market. The other 50% of what we need to operate the program comes in the form of assessments, which we are allowed to assess to companies that sell health and accident insurance. And I'm talking about indemnity companies, HMOs, Blue Cross Blue Shield, fraternals. Now, the big missing piece of that, as many of my colleagues have already mentioned, are self-insured organizations. 3M, Fingerhut, you know, the state of Minnesota itself, and even smaller companies, medium-sized companies, are starting to go self-insured. Because of the federal ERISA law, they cannot be assessed by MSHA. MCHA is opposed to House File 2384 because it hurts MSHA by reducing the assessment volume now produced from school employees and school districts that purchase insured health benefits from various carriers. This happens because the carriers that are assessed for MSHA losses shift that cost onto the customers that buy health insurance from them. On page 38 of the big Redden and Anders report, there is reference to what amount of money is that assessment estimated to be. And basically, they're saying that through a six-year projection point, in the first year, they see us losing about $4.8 million, roughly $5 million in assessed monies from the school districts, increasing to $7.8 million in year six. And I believe that has to do with inflation, the cost of health care, and so forth. So when you total that all up, in a six-year period, we're looking at about $40 million worth of assessment that has to be carried now by the remaining companies that still sell health insurance. And as my colleague, Mr. Spassetto, said from the insurance agents, this basically gets shifted onto small business and individuals that are self-employed that still buy an insured product. So you're exacerbating the problem that we've been dealing with here for many, many years. Finally, I would say that the legislature must find a different solution for lowering school employee health costs that does not seriously impact the funding method for Minnesota's health insurance safety net. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gruber. And we do appreciate the work you do at MSHA. It's a very, very important program to this state.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, with that, we will be going now to Mr. Gross, if you could please come back. We're going to go to Mr. Gross, and there's some questions for Mr. Johansson, and then we'll open it up for members to ask anyone questions that would any questions they'd like answered. And again, what we'll be looking at here is at 2:15, we'll go into recess until 5 o'clock. We'll be in room 500 north. There'll be an overflow on 300 south. Is that correct? How's that working? Oh, we'll either be in 500 north or 300 south, depending on whichever one has more room and if we have access to it. Members, if you could please put your materials in your packet for tonight's meeting so that they don't get thrown out. We want to probably be talking about some more of this information tonight here. Representative Wilkin, then Rukavina. Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gross, just getting back to the earlier line of questioning, looking at ISD 186, Rosemont Apple Valley, there at the bottom of one of the pages on 20.4, about the fifth page in. Looks like there's a 9.3% increase that that district would see. Could you explain the difference to us? Is that a one-time increase that will go back down? Is that inclusive or exclusive of healthcare inflation? Just if you could explain that number for us.
Mr. Gross.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's like the fifth page of the handout. That's the exhibit 20.4. And it's the very last line on that page.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, what if you look at the exhibit 20.4, what you're trying to, in the first, it's Region 4, which is the metro area, the first little box there talks about adjusted average, and looking at the Rosemont, Apple Valley, Eagan School District, what it's basically trying to point out is that if you look in the, what's called current structure, the current premium is $253.89. And again, this is based on a lot of assumptions, but this is sort of a ballpark figure what the current premium is for that school district. If you look at the top of that box, it says $280.13. What they're talking about for this Region 4, that's the average premium for Region 4. So thus, the Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan School District is less than the average. So what you're showing there off to the right, the 9.3%, that's how much difference there is. If you go to next year two, what they're showing here, that it's in the, it's called the transition premium. They're basically, it's 8.1% there. That's what they're saying, basically, the premiums are going to have to go up in year two. And then you go to year three, it's 8.4%, and in year four, it's 4.5%. Again, what we're trying to do is get everybody looking, for example, in year four, the racket average is $360.20. What we're trying to do, again, is get everybody toward that average number for region four here.
I'm not sure I understand what the 9.3% is, though.
Mr. Gross?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, what the 9.3% is indicating the difference between the Rosemont School District's premiums are versus the average in your area, the difference. And what we're trying to put you in it is they call it buckets, trying to get you moving up or down so you would come up to the average over the four-year period. So in a sense, the difference you have in your or there in that first box there is there's a 9.3% difference between the average rate and the Rosemont School's current rate.
So that's the increase they're going to see just going into the pool, not considering regular health care cost increases. Or is it considering regular health care cost increases? Or do we not know?
Mr. Gross?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, it's a combination of both. The trend factor, there's a trend factor built into this, around 5%. But also, it's the change that the Rosemont School District would have to go through the first year in either increasing or decreasing their premiums. And in your case, Rosemont's case, they would be an increase of that percentage in the first year.
Representative Wilkin?
Okay, so we've established that. It will be a 9.3% increase for this school district, one of which I represent. What will they, in a normal scenario, year to year we're having all sorts of health care inflation, are they going to see additional increases due to the regular health care inflation, or is this just because they're participating in the pool?
Mr. Gross?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, it's a combination of both. And I want to make a clarification here. I made a mistake. Go back to that first box. What the 9.3% is showing you the difference of this of Rosemont School District to the average in this Region 4. What we try to do in the first year is try to match each school district cost to the plan that's most similar to them. So technically, the cost differentiation you would experience in the first year is very, very little. But you'd have to go to the second year, and it's like a, if you look in that transition premium versus regular average, it's an 8.1% increase. And that 8.1% increase encompasses both the trend factor and the difference that you currently have in benefits and premiums. So we're trying to, again, phase you into a sort of like a standardized plan by year four. But also, what we're doing is changing your premiums up or down. We're also changing your benefits up or down. I know this is confusing, but the committee, everybody agreed in the committee that we would try to come up with what is called standardized plans. And what this is just trying to show the everybody is if we went to one standardized plan by year four, what would be the cost impact for each school district in based on a lot of assumptions. But in general, this is what would happen to each school district.
Mr. Chairman, why wouldn't we consider all the people with negative, all the districts with negative numbers here losers in this scheme? And why wouldn't, explain to me why they wouldn't complain, why the teachers wouldn't be losing out, because their premiums are going up by this percentage. I mean, some of them, well, they're not my districts, but some of them are going up 20-24%.
Mr. Grove?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, yeah, for the Watertown Mayor School District, their premiums, in theory, you could say over time, could go up 24%.
Representative Wilkin?
That's the Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilkin, that's the difference right now that Watertown has versus the average for that region, the cost.
Representative Colt has a problem with that area.
Thank you, Representative Wilkin. And I would say, members, when we come back at 5, if you could let the committee legislative assistant know where you're at and if you support the bill or not. If you support the bill, we'll come get you. If you don't, have a good hearing in the other meeting. So with that, Ms. Harrison Coles, did you have a to that point? You should if you don't.
Mr. Chair, not only is Watertown Mayor one of my school districts, so is I have employees in the Belle Plaine School District, the Waconia School District, the Shaska School District. This doesn't look like such a good deal for my constituents, Mr. Chair, with all due respect.
And we will address more of what that means at a later point here. I have Representative Wilkin, were you done?
I don't know, but I'll pass for now.
Representative Rukavina? Okay, with that, again, members, we'll go into recess, 500 North, 5 o'clock. Please put your material in your packet so you have it, and I thank everyone who's testified up to this point. We are in recess. We'll call the Commerce Committee meeting back to order, and we left off here now with, we finished up Mr. Gross as far as the folks that I had, but he's here, so if there's questions for anybody, we'll bring you up, but we're going to work with Mr. Johansson right now. And what I asked Mr. Johansson, there's a couple folks that had some questions for him. What I've asked him to do is, it seems a point of contention is the charts that show that there's the winners and losers charts, and everybody's looking at their own school districts, which they should be doing to see just how that works. But
I would like him, before we go into questions here, to explain that in greater detail, because I think they're being used not quite right. There's more to it than just plus 10% or minus 10%. So, Mr. Johansson, if you could spend a little time on that, and then there are some folks that have some questions for you, and then we'll go from there.
Very good, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Exhibit 20.4, which is the exhibit that lists the names of the school districts and then shows a method of transition from where districts are when purchasing their insurance independently to moving them towards a more common rate structure over a period of years. I want to point a couple of things out again in this exhibit. There's a cover letter that goes with the exhibit. In the cover letter, it clearly states in the second paragraph, this exhibit illustrates how a pool might do transition rating over a four-year period. This is clearly an example of one method that could be used to bring everybody to more common rate structures. It is not the only method, and there's nothing in the bill that says this is the method. But it is a method that could be used, and I might point out it's a method very similar to what the service cooperatives used in the Fergus Falls area when they, the one service co-op that actually, in fact, does inter-district pooling, when they move their people into a common or more common rate structure, they transition them over a period of years. It's a way to do it that eases the impact. Ultimately, we understand that in the end, the goal is the desired good that we're after, and in the end, the question before us is the pool is moving to a large pool, a large purchasing pool. A good public policy, and if it is there a method that we can use to cause the least amount of disruption along the way to getting there? I would also point out again and reiterate again that the statement in the cover letter to Exhibit 20.1 in number one, it says, please note the following, number one, and again, this exhibit is intended only to illustrate how transitional rating might work. It is not intended for any other use. It is based on numerous assumptions about plan changes and trend to 2003-2004 membership by plan and pool impact. And while the exhibit produces a good projection as a whole, it is not designed to be an exact district by district. So with that said, what we have is a snapshot. We have is freezing everybody in place and time so that what we can see is where they were at and then establish a process that projects how we move them together. What we don't know is what did their rates actually do this year? Is a district that's showing a 9.9% below average cost, did in fact they have a 25% rate increase last year and now are really 11.5% above cost? We don't know that. And we don't know that because that's not the point of this chart. This chart just simply illustrates a process for moving whoever it is that's below average to whoever it is that's above average. And so the claim to somehow be able to see on this a plan where you can go to your local districts and say you are a winner or you are a loser is simply a false assumption. If you make a false assumption when you start with this chart, you will come to a false conclusion when you deal with this chart. So with that said, I'm prepared to try to explain the process. I think Mr. Gross went through it, but I'd be happy to try to do it again. What we do is we take a school district and we take where their premiums were in 2001-2002, which is the base year we used. The reason we used that base year is because it was the last complete year before we started the study. We then put out a survey and we asked districts about changes in premiums. Some of them responded, some didn't. And so the actuary had to use actuarial methodology to move districts per member per month rates to the current year and the next year. These are actuarial assumptions. They are not solid, real numbers. But again, they don't have to be solid real numbers because they're illustrating the process. They're not identifying actual premiums.
and it would be faulty to identify per member per month costs as premiums. They're two very different things. But with that said, if I look just at the very first page, Region 1, we have an example of a district that is not a winner by the definitions that we've been using. Stephen Argyle. Is everybody able to find that?
It's Exhibit 20.4.
Yeah, Exhibit 20.4 is the very first page of tiny print, and I'm not responsible for the size of the print. Stephen Argyle, as we see that, it is a district who has 48 insured lives. 48 people are insured in their pool. If we took their current structure, their current plan design, and projected ahead to the first year of the plan, which would be 05-06, their per member per month charge, assuming that they had no change in experience, would bring $174 premiums for that year. Now, as we said, that's a giant leap because almost no district doesn't have a change in experience year to year, and especially a district with a pool of 48 people. It can be very volatile. But at any rate, its premium would be $174. If we look at the top of that column, at the very top above there, it says that the average premium for that year would be $272. See that at the very top? Okay. In the first year of this process, we take people where they're at. So we don't really adjust it much. I think it's by 0.5% right there.
Mr. Johansson, yes. Where's the 272? Yeah,
right, the 272 is at the top of the top of the
section. Oh,
okay.
Gotcha.
Okay,
gotcha.
You all see yep. At the top? Okay. Now, the 174.
I would just want you to know I was at the top of my class, a very small class.
and I don't know, but if you're like me, I suspect your vision was a little clearer at that time. So. This one's pretty tough.
Okay, we got her.
Okay.
Thank you.
Then what we see is that's a 0.5% variation it's a 5% variation or 0.5% variation in claims. We're starting where we're at. That premium is 36% below the average, is what that 36% in that far column means. Assuming that they have been frozen in place and time. And you know, we don't know that that's the case, but assuming that that's it. So they're going to have to make up. Over a transition period, they're going to have to move to the average. The next year's costs, then, show how we do this. We don't move everybody right away to the average. That would be abusive. But we move them to the average over time. And so in the first year, we take that same district and we add medical cost trend, because obviously the cost of medicine is continuing to go up, so that's added in. That's one of the assumptions that's there. And we say that their new premium will be $222, which is 26% behind the average. So you see we move them from 36 to 26% behind the average. Okay? In the third year, we move them to 273, and now they're only 15% behind the average. And in the fourth year, we move them to 336, and now they're even. Now, during this time, they've been able to take advantage of the trend, the medical cost trend, of the whole pool. Of the 200,000 people, and they haven't had to rely on the fickle nature of medical cost trends for a group of 48 people. Now, had they stayed by themselves, and they had a cancer, a car wreck, or a troubled pregnancy, their rates probably would have shot up 25 or 30% during that time. We don't know, but would they have the advantage of the trended rate spread out over 200,000 people? Does it move them 36% from where they were to where they are? Yes. But in the current marketplace, we have locals that get a 30% increase in a year.
That could be 1 year, yeah.
Not spread out over 4 years. So we really reject the idea that we have winners and losers, because in fact, while their rates are going up, they are getting the advantage of the pooled rates. And in fact, if we do nothing, what we have is losers and losers. Because, as we talked about earlier, the medical costs are escalating at a faster rate than revenues, and in fact, they simply can't afford to stand out there by themselves. And that's what's going on now. If anybody has any further questions on the meaning of this chart, I'd be happy to spend time on it. But I really do believe that this is a diversion. This is kind of one of those charts that's just too good to pass up because it has names on it. And we can all relate to the name. But by the same token, it's only a chart that an actuary can love. Because, in fact, it's filled with all sorts of actuarial assumptions and claims that, in fact, aren't apparent on the surface and therefore can bring us to cause all sorts of confusion when we try to apply it to simple language.
Mr. Johansson, do you know what an actuary is?
I don't know. You got in trouble.
I did get in trouble. When I said it was a CPA without a personality, yeah. You can't be saying that stuff.
That's okay.
I didn't know that.
Okay.
So at any rate, again, Mr. Chair, the chart is one that is just wrought for misuse and, in fact, is being misused regularly and daily by people who really want to cast fear and doubt and confusion on this whole picture.
Okay, we have questions for Mr. Johansson. And the way we're going to run this is Mr. Johansson was the one after Mr. Gross who we left off, and then we'll open it up to members, can ask any of our distinguished folks here that are for or against the bill any questions that they might have. So we'll kind of run it that way. We have the room till midnight. Although I didn't have any lunch, so Famous Dave's looks pretty good right now, too, but that's the way it goes.
Representative Gerlach.
Oh, that's quick.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have enough questions to get us till at least 7 o'clock, I think, but I'll try to limit myself to a couple. But I do want to just mention, Mr. Johansson, I agree with you that this chart doesn't really predict a lot because it's based upon so many assumptions, and I think the same can be said for the report. There are a lot of assumptions in here that aren't required in the statute. But I hope we're looking at both sides of this. I won't use it to show there are losers, but I'm hoping that we're not using it to show some teachers that they'd be winners, because I've heard from some of my teachers who are quoting these numbers, and they say, well, we've been told that this is how much we're going to gain from it. So it goes both ways. So I tend to agree that this isn't worth a heck of a lot. Two questions for you. You mentioned on page 2, line 20, there's a provision in here that says the board must arrange for one or more methods of dispute resolution so as to minimize the possibility of deadlocks. And I think that's good because that worries me a lot. But it minimizes the possibility. It doesn't eliminate it. And I still think there's a significant possibility of deadlock. I just have 7 board members and 7 union representatives. And what happens when there is a deadlock?
Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson. Just in regard to your comment about the misuse, our members received a copy of this document because it came out and because we share information with them that comes out. We have not, to this day, had a meeting or a conversation with our members where we have pointed out to them who the winners were. This is an example for transition. If they say, how would we get there, this is what we do. Now, people jump to conclusions, and if they've been told that they're losers, then they jump to the other side of it. Well, I'm a winner, you know, and so people will reach their conclusions. But I agree with you, that ought not be done. Now to your question about the governance structure. The governance structure does lend itself to deadlock. We agree with that. We think in some ways that's one of the beauties of it, because it really forces those parties to work hard at establishing the plan designs and doing the work of putting this together in a way that balances those interests, which I talked about earlier. When we talked about the need for a dispute resolution process, we talked about the binding arbitration, you know, a quick bench decision kind of binding arbitration. We talked about a method that we believe that the Department of Administration had or has a dispute resolution mechanism that they use when government agencies have a deadlock. And in fact, we wouldn't be opposed to having a specific dispute resolution process that truly brings that to a head determined for us, because we do agree that it be there. We do think, however, that it should be in such a way that it really doesn't let either party off the hook very easily and just defer to the dispute resolution process, but in fact should be something that causes them to work very hard at reaching agreement before that's triggered.
But, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Johnson.
But as it's written now, that's not the case. And what happens if there is a deadline? I'm worried that there could be a statewide strike.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. One of the things that I think is important to remember here is that the collective bargaining authority, so the exclusive rep employer relationship, stays at the local level. We do not propose that there be any transfer of that authority to a state level. And so the plan design and the setting of premiums is done away from the bargaining table. It's a separated issue. So I think the chances that you're going to be able to coordinate 341 separate independent school districts in some sort of a strike, my real job title is negotiation specialist. And I'd sooner herd cats, as they say, than to try to coordinate 341 schools. So I don't think it lends itself to that. I think because the bargaining over who pays the premiums, that split employer-employee payment, the bargaining of all of the details of the economics of this package are done at the local district, 341 separate contracts, that in fact we aren't going to have the chance of a statewide strike over this. Now, with that said, we would not be opposed, and my assumption is that the first order of business that this committee would do is establish that dispute resolution process. But in fact, if that has to be encoded, that's fine too.
Okay.
Mr. Johnson?
I mean, but it's not in there, and we still haven't answered what happens if there's an impasse. If there's not a strike, do they just not have health care for their teachers, or?
Mr. Johansson? Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. The parties are responsible people, and they would have to come to a conclusion. But again, the first order of business is to establish that dispute resolution process. It's my experience that it's best to establish a process before you have an active issue. Because if you have an active issue, you're likely to try to skew the process to your advantage. So it's the first order of business that they do is establish a dispute resolution process that, in fact, puts that behind them, makes a decision in that issue, and moves them on to the next item on the agenda. Then I think that we've overcome that. Think that we're okay, and we'll work on it. And again, as I say, if somebody would believe that a specific dispute resolution process would be preferable, and if that was written into the statute, as long as it didn't take that decision away too quickly, we would, and it was balanced, we wouldn't oppose that.
Representative Johnson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll give up on that. Can I just ask one more?
And as you'd like, sir. Representative Johnson?
There has been a lot of talk about the $223 million in structural cost savings, and we've been getting little pieces of what that is, and my understanding is a big chunk of it is actually not savings. It's a transfer, essentially, to someone else through MSHA. And I think I understand that some of the rest of it is based upon some assumptions that people have questioned, but maybe you could lay out for us where that true 23 comes.
Sure.
Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Representative Johnson. I refer you all to exhibit number 13 in the study. And as a preface to my answering the question, I would point out that by moving to a self-insured pool, as I understand it under federal law, ERISA, self-insured pool is not subject to those assessments and premium taxes. And so as kind of a side effect of moving to a self-insured pool, which are good reasons to do, the MSHA assessment comes into play. And we would move school teachers into a similar MSHA arrangement as state employees are currently in, where we wouldn't pay the MSHA assessment as you don't pay the MSHA assessment. And as service cooperatives currently don't pay the MSHA assessment, which really brings us to the great unfairness of this system. Currently, half of the school employees are already MSHA exempt, and half of them aren't. The funding mechanism that we have in place for MSHA, with all due respect to anybody and everybody who's ever had something to do with it, has lost its clarity of how it is that this is a just mechanism. And in fact, we would work with anybody in this body to help reestablish a just and equitable method for funding MSHA. But we think to assess people who have fully insured products and exempt people who have self-insured products and to exempt your own employees from the assessment is somehow an example of the dysfunctional system that we have. But again, we would be willing to work with you very hard to come up with an equitable method of funding MSHA. So with that said, on Exhibit 13, which I referred you to, the top part of that chart has numbers in terms of millions of dollars. The bottom part of that chart is what percent of premiums that $1 million represents. So you can see that the estimate revenue in MSHA assessments appears two places on that chart. And as you can see, there would be, in the first year, as you can see, in that first year, there would be considerable savings in premium taxes in MSHA, $10.18 million, and it would move up due to medical cost inflation and premium increases up to $16 million over the years. And again, that equals about 37% of all savings. So it is a very large portion of the savings. We understand that, but nonetheless, we think that the issue of MSHA is an issue that has to be addressed in another manner. The second column, elimination of commissions. When we move to a mandatory purchasing pool, we eliminate commissions. In our current circumstance, brokers and agents provide good services for teachers and school districts. They help try sort through the maze of offerings. But in fact, when we move to a mandatory purchasing pool, there isn't a need for their services, and we would save those millions of dollars in premiums. The next category is administrative expenses, and those folks who like to pop holes in our assumptions like to suggest that our administrative cost estimates are low. And so in order to kind of cast some light on that, I would ask you to flip back to exhibit number 11. And if you look at exhibit number 11, you'll see we did a sampling of other kinds of pools for school employees in other states. And you can see, for instance, Tennessee has 8.7% administrative fees, but you also see it's a voluntary pool.
Mr. Johansson, what page is
it? It's exhibit number 11, which is in the exhibits, and the pages aren't numbered. You've got to go to the back of it, and then the exhibits are numbered in numerical sequence.
Okay.
So the back half of it. Has everybody found that exhibit?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
On the other side of it, if you look at North Carolina, you can see North Carolina has a mandatory pool, which they actually administer for 2.7%. So you can see there's a pretty good range. Mandatory pools are less costly to administer because you don't have to go chasing after members. You know who your people are. And so we looked at that. And so there's a wide range there of costs. Then what we did is we went out and we sent all of the data that we collected in the study, and it's a tremendous volume of data. The actuary sent it to the various insurance providers that do business both in Minnesota and some that don't currently do business in Minnesota. And we asked them a couple of questions. One of them was, if we put together a pool this size, would you be interested in administering that pool? Next question was, if you were interested in administering that pool, can you give us an example of what your rate structures would be like? And I can't remember the exact number, but a couple of companies that don't do business in Minnesota now said, for that size of a pool, for that book of business, we will come into the state. So in fact, we expand competition. Then the second question was, what is your fee structure going to look like? And as you can see then, if you flip back one page to chart 10, you can see at the top of that chart a summary of what the various companies said they thought that they could administer that pool at. We believe that looking at what other state pools are administered at and looking at the examples that we received, we could take the average of the lowest half as an example, and that puts it at 5.65%, as you can see in that chart. Average of lowest half, 5.64%, excuse me. And that's the methodology that was used to arrive at the administrative savings that are found in exhibit number 13. Okay? So as you can see, we would reduce costs by $6.85 million in the first year, moving up to $12.74 million in the sixth year. I'm going to pause for a minute because everybody's flipping pages and it becomes somewhat difficult to keep up sometimes. Now, the next area, as you can see on the chart, is contribution to reserves differences. Currently, school districts are paying under their current arrangements, they're paying about a little more than $10 million into various reserve funds. In the first year of operation, we would divert that, not what's already in their reserves, that's a matter of law of what happens to those monies, but that annual contribution would be diverted into our reserve fund. And as you can see, in the first 2 years, we would then add $21+ million to the reserve fund in each of those first 2 years, arriving then at the end of the second year with a reserve fund that was about 9.8% of premiums. Now, that issue, that reserve amount, has not been out without controversy. I would point out the following. When you have a pool, the larger your pool, the smaller your percent of premiums your reserve has to be. If you have a very small pool, one big bill will blow you through your reserve, and you have to have a much higher percentage-wise of reserve. When you have a $600 million claims, you're dealing at a large level, you got a large amount of money, $60 million is still, well, certainly not impossible to blow through, we know that, but it's less likely to blow through on that kind of a large scale, especially when you add the fact that this is a mandatory pool. This pool is not volatile. You don't have people jumping in and jumping out. Therefore, the added adverse selection problems you get when people move in and out. This is a mandatory pool. It's stable. You know your membership. You can predict with near certainty the number of incidences of the various claims that you're going to have. And so you have a much better chance of setting your premiums at a realistic rate when you know who your clientele is. So therefore, that reserve, we believe, is sufficient. I would point out to you that the state of Pennsylvania, the legislature of the state of Pennsylvania, hiring the Hay Group, did a study that they issued at approximately the same time that this study was issued, and they asked the question, would a mandatory statewide health insurance plan for all school employees be feasible? And while they found the answer to be yes, they determined that an 8.3% reserve would be sufficient. 1 month's premiums. Again, they would be a little larger, and therefore the percent can be a little smaller. But we can ultimately argue about whether this is a sufficient reserve, but as the pool starts to operate, if in fact this isn't a sufficient reserve, over the period of time, if we start to find problems, we can adjust this. This is not chiseled in stone. This is an example of a target. And in fact, as we see the market, when we're creating this pool, we can adjust that. Would that affect the savings? Of course it would. But the point is, these are examples of where we believe we can go using an actuary who has no reason to fudge the numbers because the actuary gets his check whether I like his results or not. So that's after that second year with $60+ million in the reserve, the reserve funds would continue to generate investment revenue and would grow as investments grew, thus turning about $10.5 million, that $10 million they're currently paying that we diverted, now that would become a savings because you no longer have to put that into the reserve fund over time. Now, if you underestimate your claims and underestimate your premiums, you're going to have to add back into that. I mean, if you dip into your reserve, you're going to have to add back into that. We accept that. But we believe that we won't have that problem. Then finally, stop-loss insurance. Pools establish stop-loss at a rate that's consistent with their size. A small pool has to buy stop-loss at a lower rate, simply because money available. A smaller claim will cause a bigger problem for them. The actuary, again, determined that a $500,000 stop loss would be doable. And if you look at the chart, I wish I had this memorized a little bit better than I do. If you look at exhibit number five, I'll pause for a minute.
I wrote questions online that are not here.
Nothing left in mind.
Okay, if you look at exhibit number five, you see an actual claims history of what have been experienced in 2000, 2001, and then in 2001, 2002. And what I want to point out here is that the vast majority of the claims that we experience are below $100,000. And there are fewer than 200 claims out of 200,000 people that are above that. And as you can see, above the $500,000 level in 2001, there were only three claims that were above that $500,000 level. And if you look in the 2001-2002 category, you find two claims. They're larger, but they're two claims. So the point being that because you have so few claims that go above that, your stop-loss premiums are substantially lower, and you end up saving considerable amount of money. Now, it is true that now the pool is paying up to the $500,000 level. So that money that's reflected in Exhibit 13 for savings, the 5.75, is not what reflects in the reduction in premiums, because the reduction in premiums is much more than that. But then we have to pay the claims up to the $500,000. So you see how we arrive at that number. And in fact, we save between $5.74 and $9.85 million a year on that. There's some incidental savings down at the bottom. But if you add those charts, those numbers together, you get $223 million in savings during the first 6 years, which equals 4.1% of premiums. I would point out that if you calculated your percent of claims or percent of savings from the third year on, once your reserve is built, the savings are a much higher percent, because now you're no longer having to put $21 million a year into that reserve. So the savings is a percent of claims a much greater number in the out years as opposed to the first years. Representative Johnson, does that kind of give you a thumbnail sketch?
Could you repeat that?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair Chadley, I've done that.
Quiet.
Can you not let Johnson ask any more questions?
You said you wanted to tell seven, so that's... Yeah. Representative Johnson?
I've been secretly threatened with violence by someone. I'll stop. I do just want to say, I think there are a lot of questions about this number, and I think that 20-minute answer maybe testifies to that to a certain extent.
Okay. Representative Mallory Mahoney Osterman.
I just got a room. He was answering one question.
I want a
I
thorough.
The room for 15 minutes.
I want a thorough hearing. Thorough hearing. Representative Mallory.
I just heard this. Never asked for. I'm a little concerned that you're confusing the two of us.
Same hairstyle.
He's the one that always
we do it together.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hansen, I have a question concerning large districts. When you were figuring this whole thing out here, and these numbers right here, did you take into account that most of the large pools now negotiate discounts? I'm under the impression that it's not uncommon for some of our larger school districts to have premiums less than their actual costs. Is that factored in here, or...
Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Davis.
Either one of the studies would do.
Chairman, Representative Mahoney, their current premiums are factored in there. Whether or not they're discounting them to the point where they have a loss, the actuary would have to be the one who answers that question.
Let me rephrase the question then. Did you figure in the actual insurance, did you figure in the actual claims cost into this, or are you using just the premium costs?
Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the actual claims experience, we were fortunate enough to have written into the statute that created the committee a requirement that the insurance providers supply claims data to us, and in fact they did. So it's claims made, claims paid, is how the cost is calculated.
Representative Mahoney?
I've been called parochial. Defensive. And that's just by my friends.
That's just by me.
And my mayor has it on tape.
Well, you know, if you'd ever repeat me correctly,
he doesn't go to Chicago for attorneys.
As I look at this, there's going to be substantial costs to my school district. Am I supposed to ask them to take that out of their school budget, or are you covering that, or are you asking us to cover that? How are we going to do that? Because whatever they take out in insurance premiums, they're going to take out of the classroom somewhere along the line.
Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, this is big money, and some districts have been fortunate over a few years to have relatively level premiums. Others haven't. Large district, Anoka, the last 2 years they've experienced on their own in a self-insured pool 43% premium increase. There is nothing in this system that protects a district under its current arrangement from spikes in premiums, even the large districts. Anoka is either the second or the third largest district in the state, depending on what day the numbers are read. To do nothing, the question comes down, where is your school going to pay for its premiums next year? Where is the money going to come from? And the fact is that it's already eating up, in aggregate, more money than new revenue. So to do nothing isn't the answer. And we believe that, in fact, we're able to arrest that runaway rate escalation, and we're able to create a rate structure that will go up with trend, but with 200,000 lives will not likely have the spikes that we see in the current system. So it'll become more manageable, more predictable. In fact, your district will then be able to accommodate those changes more than they would under the current system. But to do nothing, your question is just as valid with that. How will they pay their premiums if we do nothing? And the answer is, it's a conundrum. It's a problem.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So in other words, if we pass this, my district has got to pay higher costs for their insurance for the immediate future.
I don't know which district is yours.
St. Paul.
Jim Mahoney.
I think St. Paul, if I were to look at the winners and losers chart, which I wouldn't do because that would be inappropriate, but I think that it shows that it's a slightly above average cost district, and therefore that wouldn't be the case. But some of the districts are listed twice because if they have two carriers, and I may have looked at only one of the carriers.
Well,
Representative Mahoney.
I wouldn't look at this either, but I'm under the impression that this bill costs my district a lot of money every year for the next 4 years. One other question, and earlier today there was I've been hearing $230 or $270 million in savings, and I think it was Mr. Gross, so you may be able to respond to this. You may have to call it Mr. Gross, or are we calling him up later?
We're doing Mr. Johansson now, so we'll go through whoever you want to go through.
Well, I'll start with you, and then maybe if you would like to defer to him, you can answer. You can do that, and I'll ask the same question to him. It'll give him time to think of an answer. $250 million has been what's been put out as the savings that this would come up with, and this morning someone said $700 million in savings, and then the answer was that come out as out of savings out of other areas. Now, could you define other areas? Would you like Mr. Gross to define that as higher copays and higher deductibles?
The figure that I've been using, the savings, you know, the structural cost savings figure, is $23 million. Now we have in the document several prototype plans we put out as examples of the types of plans that would be made available, ranging from plan number one, which is a fairly comprehensive plan with no deductible and 10% copays for hospitals and so forth, all the way to a high deductible consumer directed plan, which would have $1,000 deductible. Depending on which one of these plans a local district were to determine they were going to provide through a locally negotiated contract, they could experience savings within the benefit structure. But I'm not prepared to talk about $700 million savings or whatever, because, in fact, the benefit structure is something that's going to be decided at the local level, which of the choices in this menu they would go for. And Mr. Gross, I think, mentioned that amount of money, and I don't know where that is, so you're going to have to ask him about that.
Representative Mahoney?
Well, I'll wait for Mr. Gross to come, because I've got about four other questions that go through that with that, and I'd hate to be accused of being... No, Mr. Gross, I hate to get threats of great bodily harm.
They come for me, by the way.
Okay, any Representative Osterman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Osterman, no. First of all, no government plans are covered by ERISA. So in other words, we could do whatever we want with a government plan. We could make them pay MCHA assessments, whether it's the DUER plan for state employees or whether it's a pool of a political subdivision or a pool of political subdivisions like this one would be, or if it's a pool of or if it's an individual subdivision that is self-insuring on its own, for instance, like Anoka-Hennepin, we could make them pay the MCHA assessment. And in general, the only self-insured plan that is protected under ERISA is a self-insured plan of a single private employer. So if a group of private employers get together and pool, and they're self-insured, it's a self-insured pool, we can impose the MCHA assessment on them, and in fact we do in state law. So the only self-insured entity that's exempt from MCHA and other state laws is a self-insured plan operated by a single private employer.
Representative Osterman?
Okay, any questions, more questions for Mr. Johansson? Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay, the next one, Mr. Gross, I know there's some questions for you. And then members, if you have anybody, you know, you want to pull out of the audience, ask questions to, feel free to. Mr. Gross and Representative Mahoney.
So, Mr. Gross, can you explain the difference between the 223 and the 700 million?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, what that entails is going to those new plans down the road. And we're looking at what is called Plan 1. And we're looking at Plan 1 where it has higher co-insurance amounts, it has a higher out-of-pocket expense limitation, et cetera, et cetera. So the savings that I was talking about earlier today is generated with a higher cost sharing by the employees, meaning they pay more out of their own pocket in the form of co-insurance, deductibles, stuff like that. What you're doing is shifting the costs. You're going to have two things going to happen. One, there's going to be less utilization because the person will say, oh, I got a sore shoulder. Should I run down to the doctor or should I take two aspirin and see how I feel tomorrow? Because there's, let's say, a $25 or a $50 copayment that they have to incur to go to see the doctor now. Before, there was no roadblock or speed bump in the way. They just went simply to the doctor, and there was no cost sharing. Now, let's say there's $25 there. You might say, okay, I'm not going to go there. So there's going to be less utilization. The second thing that will happen is because you're paying part of the bill, you're sharing in the actual cost. Not the school district has to pay for it anymore, but you do now.
Representative Mahoney?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's nice to see that Minnesota Education Minnesota and has become a division of the Insurance Federation. That's about all I have to say.
Any more questions for Mr. Gross? Let's open that. Okay. Oh, Representative Rucamina.
I don't know if Mr. Gross is the right guy to ask.
Okay.
I'm just curious, what are the spikes or what's happened in the state health plan? Correct me if I'm wrong. We're self-insured. We have Blue Cross managing it as a third party, right?
Mr. Gross?
What's happened in increases over the last few years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucamina, I think, well, unfortunately for all of us, I don't care if we could be in a private market, the state employees or a school district, health care costs have gone up. So that's why I think the state of Minnesota implemented this year more cost sharing into their plan, just because of the increasing costs.
Representative Rucamina?
Since this Mr. Johansson's been walking around here for 3 years, and you know, I've tried to ask a lot of questions because I'm concerned that just like Representative Mahoney, and they call me a parochial horse is behind them. Well, me, you know, in my district, I'm worse than you. Don't worry about. And I'm worried that, and I'm still worried, like I said this morning. So, you know, they've referred to this plan as comparing it to the savings we get from the state health plan. And being members of our 40,000 state employees or whatever it is, Mr. Gross, that belong to the state health plan. And so, you know, Mr. Chair, you've heard a lot of testimony here today, and I heard, well, how good is the state health plan doing? What have been our increases? We've had more co-pays. We've had more restrictions on who we can go to visit. We can't go to the mail without getting permission from the doctor. I can't go to somebody down here when I'm down here 5 days a week, and if I need something, or I got a stiff shoulder for 4 months now, I won't go to the doctor just because I'm scared. Every time I go, something else happens to me. But anyway, you know, it's a whole other issue. But, you know, what are our uses? Compare the state health plan to what we're talking about here. What are our cost increases been? What has our coverage been? Is it getting better or worse? Are we paying more or less?
Mr. Gross, to that point, doesn't the state health plan have like three different plans? I mean, not everybody in the state health plan is in the state health plan. Aren't some with Medica and...
Mr. Chairman, there's one plan everybody has, basically the same. I mean, you pick and choose which level of coverage you want, but there's the three plans are just administering it, that's all.
If we could add to that to Representative Rucamina's question, please identify yourself for the record, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dave Haugen with the Minnesota Department of Employee Relations. We administer the State Employee Group Insurance Program, which is the health insurance program for state employees. Just by way of comparison, we currently provide health coverage for approximately over 48,000 employees, about 120,000 total covered lives. We have been a completely self-funded pool since the year 2000. I don't have the exact annual rates of increase in front of me, but I think I can get pretty close from memory. In the late 1990s, preceding the introduction of our current Advantage health benefits plan, we had a couple of years of very high rates of increase, approaching 20% annual rates of increase in the late 1990s. We became self-insured, got better data about ourselves, went into the 2001 round of collective bargaining with the unions. I think it was very apparent that we had to make some major changes. We introduced at that time the new Advantage program, which is a program in which we've identified the costs of the providers serving our patients, and we've arrayed those costs from low to high. Where there's some natural price breaks, we've drawn some lines and created three cost levels initially. And while everyone was charged the same premium, the amount of their copays and deductibles and so forth varied depending on the cost level of the provider that they used. When we introduced the Advantage program, our rate of increase was between 8 and 9%. It reverted the next year to, again, about what the medical trend was, double-digit rates of increase. Going into the 2003 round of collective bargaining, which occurred primarily last summer and last fall, if we had taken no action, if the existing Advantage status quo plan had continued, we were looking at about a 9.98% rate of increase. Just by way of comparison, as we benchmarked ourselves against other similar large programs based on a whole host of national studies and surveys and so forth, it seemed like the average national rate of increase was about 14% among many employers. As a result of this latest round of bargaining, which was conducted in the shadow of the state's $4.2 billion deficit, there were some fairly major changes again to the design of the Advantage program, including the introduction of a new fourth cost level to really reflect the fact that serving our employees are some very, very costly providers. And associated with the introduction of that fourth cost level were additional levels of cost sharing as well. And so as a result of the changes in bargaining, our rate of increase from 2003 to 2004, which had been about 9.98 if no action had been taken, has been brought much closer now to virtually no increase at all for this year. We're still anticipating that we will be subject, like everybody else, to sort of the natural medical trend, which, so far as we can tell, is now running somewhere in the 13 to 15% category. So that's what we're expecting probably in that neighborhood coming up, unless something else changes.
Mr. Rokovina?
Mr. Chair, question for Mr. Hall and Mr. Gross, but this proposal here that we're looking at in your bill, Mr. Chair, isn't a self-insured or is.
It is
self-insured, so they would have a similar type Blue Cross or someone bid on managing it, and that board that's in the bill would then push them. Mr. Chair, maybe what we should do is just amend your bill and let all public employees in the state join in the state plan. Would you accept that as a friendly
man? I'd have to give it just a bit of thought.
Because we already have something established and set up in law, and if they want to mirror it after us, then there's no savings. The savings in this plan is the savings to the members that are getting insurance, and I can sympathize with the fear of some of our people in the education, whether they're bus drivers or teachers, that they're afraid of what might happen in the future. So we've already got a plan. If this is working, then, as Mr. Hogan says, at the appropriate time, I'll just move to let every public employee in the state. I went to my caucuses last night, Mr. Chair. You're right there with my buddy, Dennis Kucinich, and your views. So I want to commend you for moving towards our ideas. And,
we're twins separated at birth.
But let me tell you got about four-fifths of the body. You've never seen Mr. Kucinich in person.
We're proud tonight. And a couple points on that. First of all, some of the concerns about the possibility of a statewide strike, that would change that whole dynamic. It would take away the local bargaining for each school district to be able to do that. There's some things that I'd have some concerns about.
Sure, then let's get to that, because I didn't understand what was said by Mr. Joe Hansen this morning. And now help me with this, Mr. Hogg or somebody. Are they going to just have a menu to pick from? They're going to have then three or four plans like you offer us, and then that's what they negotiate at the local level?
Yes.
They don't negotiate and say, I want, they're just going to have the same thing you and I. There's no negotiation. We look at which plan we want and how much we want to pay and who we can go to in our area, and that's what I'm assuming is going to be the same thing in this plan.
No, Representative Rokovina, what it would be is the school board and the teachers union would agree on which plan they're going to offer all members. Isn't that correct, Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Chair, the school district and the union could...
Why don't you come up to the microphone here?
the scenario outlined in the study, Mr. Chair, Representative Rugavina, is that the plan managers, the board, would establish, we suggest, four plan designs, and in fact, I shudder to think, I don't want to refer you to yet another exhibit in the manual, but there is an exhibit that shows what those benefit structures are that are prototype. They're the ones that we use as an example. There are four, shall we call them, traditional plans, deductibles, copay kind of arrangements, and then there are two that fit into the consumer-directed model with VEBA plans or health reimbursement arrangements and health savings arrangements. The local school district and the unions representing people who work for them would negotiate which among those plans they would want to offer. For instance, if you go to a consumer-directed plan with a VEBA account or a health reimbursement arrangement, generally speaking, the recommendation is that you probably shouldn't offer other plans of the more traditional nature because you're going to get some real adverse selection then. In years when people plan to have a baby, they're going to go into the pay-it-all plan and keep their health reimbursement arrangement money separate, and then when they have the baby, they'll go back. You know, that sort of fear. But that would be a decision that would be made at the local level as to whether they want to go into this plan design or whether they want to go to the traditional plan designs. The local would then determine whether or not they wanted to make available all four plan designs or whether they wanted to restrict it to just one or two of the plan designs that would be offered. So those decisions would be made at the local bargaining table. The pool would establish the plan designs and provide the rates, so you would know what it is that was going to cost you when you bargained for whatever plan designs you have.
So, Mr. Johansson, you could have multiple. They could negotiate to have multiple within one district.
Yes, Mr. Chair, they could negotiate to allow a selection of a menu of those plans. Yes,
Representative Rukavina.
No, I mean that's basically what.
Representative Goodwin, was your question to Mr. Gross or?
My question is to Mr. Hawken.
Okay. Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hawken, you said, I want to get this correct, that that other employers experienced a 14% increase in this last year. Is that correct?
Mr. Hawken.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in looking at the projected rates of increase from calendar 2003 to 2004, we looked at a variety of reports. There are a number of large national actuarial firms that do large national surveys periodically. We collected the results from, I believe it was the Siegel Group. We looked at Hewitt. There are a number of other large, well-known groups that do these large national surveys. And where they seem to be coming in and sort of coming to some relative consensus was that they were projecting anticipated rates of increase calendar 03 to 04 in about the 13% to 15% range.
Okay. Thank you. And
is that a good one?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Hogan, at the same time, those I know that Dewar looks at this when they go into bargaining because I've been in those situations, but at the same time, those employees and that are having their costs increased by 13% to 15% are also losing benefits, are they not? They're also paying higher co-pays and they're getting reduced health care.
Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, there seems to be an ongoing trend over the last few years of greater participation by employees in the costs, both on the premium side and then both in terms of out-of-pockets like co-pays and deductibles and those kind of things.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hogan, then I'm trying to understand the argument against the statewide health plan because I truly don't. And I know that the Chamber has testified and several of the in the insurance industry has testified. If the employees are still going to get options of, or at least the local school district is going to get options of different kinds of plans, and if it could be a good thing as far as reducing the cost to employees, and quite possibly they won't have any better or worse situation than employees are out there now that are getting lowered benefits and higher costs, why? What's the downside to doing this? I mean, you're coming from the state employee perspective, but what I don't see the downside of our chair's bill. I see only the upsides of your bill, Mr. Chair. So, could you tell me what's the resistance besides there are certain insurance companies are going to lose money. The Minnesota Chamber is not doing a whole lot to get their small businesses insurance and to try to get those folks, self-employed people, covered. I believe that their dues are based on the size of the companies that are members of the chamber, and I know the insurance industry is members of the chamber. If there's been this huge study on this, and they've come up with a plan that might make sure that teachers still have and school staff have insurance in years to come, what is the downside of doing this?
Mr. Hogan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there's been a lot of testimony from both proponents and opponents. We've provided or tried to provide as much technical assistance as we could. I really don't know that I could speak on behalf of anyone else as to their views regarding this issue. Perhaps Mr. Gross or some of the other people with testimony might care to respond. But the actuary, I think, in looking at this study, tried to look at a number of issues related to some possible administrative economies of scale, primarily from the pooling, also looking at standardizing and reducing the array of benefit options, because so far as I can understand the study, the greater the array, the greater the number and variety, the more administrative costs and expense and so forth associated with that. So that by narrowing that array and by also having a bigger group to spread some fixed costs over, you can achieve some of these administrative economies of scale. And then beyond that, I think there's a great deal of discussion about a whole variety of issues. There has been certainly discussion in this committee about what has been called the winners and losers kind of concept and others. I guess I don't really feel prepared to address those in much detail.
Is that a good one?
Thank you, Mr. Hogan. I have a couple questions for other opponents to this when we get to them, and I don't know how you want to do that,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Mr. Hogan?
Representative Goodwin, pick who you'd like to ask questions to. And we'll see if any other members have questions for that person.
Exciting. I guess I'd like to...
Before Mr. Hogan leaves, can I ask...
Representative Brookovini, yes, sir.
Sure. Yeah. Mr. Hogan, you know, this morning we heard like what the exes charge on top for management fees. What is Blue Cross and Blue Shield? What was their bid award? And what percentage do they? What do they get for managing them?
Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it was reported, I believe, that our state employee group insurance program has an overall administrative cost as a percent of claims that I think was last measured at about 9.8 or 9.9%. That was in a 2002 report by the Office of Legislative Auditor, where they actually came in and did a program evaluation, very in-depth, detailed analysis of our costs and our program. That was based on 2000 or 2001 data. Since that time, we haven't had another official audit like that, but I've just asked internally for some updated numbers. And if you take the expenses of people like me, we consider what I do here as part of our administrative expense, as well as what we pay to the health plans, and we contract currently with three health plans, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, and Preferred One, to do a variety of administrative functions, primarily adjudicate claims and process them, rent their networks to us, provide some overall disease management services, some customer support, and those kind of things. The latest, again, unaudited number that I've heard is that we're looking at probably about 8 to 8.5% of claims for all of the administrative functions that we do. It's a little bit difficult to make apples-to-apples comparison sometimes because of what people classify as administrative expense. As you perhaps know, benefits for state employees are by and large bargained in collective bargaining. We play a very, very big role in that. Health insurance has been really the major issue in at least the last two rounds of bargaining. And so we have become very involved, as have our actuaries, with all of their attendant costs in modeling and making projections and doing a lot of iterations in the course of bargaining before we finally reach a settlement. Well, We call those part of our administrative costs, and so we include those as well. I'm not sure if others talking about their administrative costs would even have the bargaining that we do and have those kind of costs.
So, Mr. Chair, you mean even include the entire state negotiation process or just the health insurance portion?
Just the health insurance portion of it, but that's a very big piece of it because of its importance.
And Mr. Hogan, Mr. Chair, what are we talking about in dollars? What are those three insurance companies that we contract with get in actual dollars if it's 8.5% or 9.5%?
Mr. Hogan?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have an exact figure for you, but we're very rapidly approaching, in round number terms, almost $400 million a year in claims. And so
40, 30,
somewhere in 35 to 40 million is probably a good estimate.
And Mr.
Rukavina?
And Mr. Hogan, have there been any kind of studies or anything of that nature that would indicate what it would cost the state to completely manage their plan?
Mr. Hogan?
Maybe we could hire Ms. Lethal when she's here yet.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Mr. Chair, Representative, prior to the year 2000, our program operated as a partially self-insured program through Blue Cross, but we also offered insured products through Health Partners. Preferred one. In going to a completely self-insured model, we worked with the actuaries to try and figure out the best way to do that. And I think what we felt is that contracting with the health plans at the rates that we're getting was really the best way to go. When the OLA conducted its study in 2002 and looked at our operation, and they said our admin costs were 9 or 10%, they said on average for a group our size, they would expect that you should be under 12.5. And we were quite a bit under the 12.5 that they were projecting at that time. So I'm not aware of particular studies or information about that other than the own internal work that we've done in going self-insured in 2000. And the fact that against other benchmarks, we seem to be at or below the expected level of administrative costs.
Member Cabina. Okay, Representative Goodwin, who would you like to call up?
Is there somebody here from the School Board Association or the Association of Metropolitan School Districts? I guess, is Scott Kroonquist here?
Is Grace here? Or who is the person we skipped today?
Oh, AMSD, Scott Kroonquist.
Is Scott Kroonquist here?
Grace is here.
And as I said earlier, Mr. Kroonquist, we didn't get to, if we get this bill out of here, he'll be first on our list for the next meeting. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Grace Schwab, and I'm Director of Governmental Relations for the Minnesota School Boards Association.
Representative Goodwin?
Ms. Schwab, I don't know if you'll know the answer to this because you represent the school boards, and I'm really looking for the school administration. And I'll ask you and see if you know. I might have to ask Mr. Kroonquist, but no one isn't. Do the administrators in the school districts have a different plan or a better plan or a better retirement health plan than the teachers and the other school staff?
Ms. Schwab.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, oftentimes our school administrators will have an enhanced version of the contract the teachers are. So, yes, it's sort of based on and lowered, layered above, mm-hmm. probably with enhancements in pension and probably health plans also.
That's a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you, can you give us any details about how much better that is? Is it across the board? Is it that they get health benefits upon retirement when teachers don't, or teachers get a reduced amount?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I don't have any exact details on it, but oftentimes it'll look at those kinds of issues. And this Charlie Kite with the school superintendents would be able to give you more information on that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Schwab. The reason I'm asking these questions is because I understand that they do. They have a much better plan. And the real reason that the School Boards Association and AMSD are fighting this bill is because those administrators are afraid of losing the premier plans they have over the teachers and the school district staff. And if that's the case, I think I have a real problem with that.
Ms. Schwaber.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the administrators, and maybe I misspoke myself, have an enhancement of what the teachers receive, so it's the same plan. They may get a more dollar amount. Normally when school boards negotiate with their staffs, they'll say, and I'd probably say half my school districts will say, we will cover 75% of a plan. Now, if in fact we went to the statewide model, we would have to articulate what that means in dollars, not knowing what plan would be available or how that. But that's normally how we arrive at a bargaining position. The other place is we will say a set dollar amount. Anything above that amount will be covered by the employee. And those superintendents are compensated differently. They have the same plan, only the dollar contribution by the district or the percentage amount covered by the district would be different.
Sam Goodwin.
Thank you. Ms. Schwab, then the superintendents and the administrators in the school districts would have a lot to gain, or at least they assume they would, by staying with the current plan that they have. And you said that, and it's true, the teachers and the school staff have to negotiate for their health care benefits, but who negotiates for the administrators' health care benefits that are so much better than the staff's?
Ms. Schwab?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, there are administrative bargaining groups similar to the teachers' bargaining group, and it is negotiated exactly like you negotiate the teachers. It's just with a different group. We negotiate with administrators, we negotiate with teachers, we negotiate with cooks, we negotiate with maintenance staff. We have probably six or seven different bargaining units, depending on your school district, that we negotiate with, administration being one of them.
Sam Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Schwab. Who are the bargaining units for the administrative staff and the superintendents? Who are they?
Ms. Schwab.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, they would be made up of members. You know, I if we had an exact school district, you know, you could maybe find that out. But generally, it's made up of just principals and administrators who actually work with the board or the board's attorney in coming up with a negotiated settlement, very similarly to the way we do with teachers. Only teachers oftentimes have outside assistance.
Sam Goodwin.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Ms. Schwab. So in other words, they negotiate for themselves and they negotiate a better package than what the school districts are willing to negotiate for the teachers and the staff.
Ms. Schwab.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, once again, they usually have an enhanced amount. I wish I could give you actual data numbers as to what those plans are and the differences, but I don't have that at my fingertips.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would like to get that in my office as soon as you can get that to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't have access to that information. The school administrators would be the ones that you really want to look at.
Thank you.
So it'll be the Mr. Kroonquist?
No,
that's Metropolitan.
Kite.
Mr. Kite? Okay. Members, the page just passed out a position statement from the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, position on the school employee insurance plan design committee report. That's from Mr. Kroonquist, who, if this bill gets out of here, will be the first to testify against me at the next meeting. So with that,
I'll live with that.
Any other members have any questions for anybody, or are we ready to vote here? Representative Sikora. Certainly. Certainly. Mr. Brinkman?
Did you see this?
Please state your name, who you represent for the record, please.
Walk, you know. Chairman, my name is Paul Brinkman. I'm with the Northeast Service Cooperative.
Let me tell you what your answer your question is.
Representative Sikora.
What I wanted to ask you about was when you testified
everybody
early on, I know it was earlier today, but it sounded like you're offering a lot of what this new
Mr. Brinkman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sikora, thank you for the opportunity to respond. As mentioned earlier today, and Mr. Haugen just talked about the same issue, in the most recent audited report, CGIB was reported at 9.9% structural costs, administrative costs. The report that was submitted by Reed and Anders, when we were requested to submit our administrative costs, we listed administration to Blue Cross Blue Shield at 6%, service cooperative at 1.5% for a total of 7.5%. We have a network access fee that takes a percent and a half off the 7.5% for a net administrative cost of 6%. So that was the administrative cost reported from the service cooperatives to Reed and Anders, 6% in the aggregate statewide. The other report that we submitted into testimony, if I may be so bold, Mr. Chairman, to mention on the Senate side, I'm not sure if that's appropriate or not because I'm not down here enough, but on the Senate side, we did submit a report dated January 7th from Milliman USA that talks about, according to a report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, the state group reported a 13% cost increase in 1999, followed by 23% in 2000 and 18% in 2001. Kaiser Family Foundation KPMG survey indicated health insurance premium increases nationwide during the same period were 4.8%, 8.3%, and 11% respectively. The state cost increases were 8%, 15%, and 7% greater than the average national increase. During that same period of time, I do not have the aggregate increases. We could provide them for you, but at the service cooperatives, they would be in between those two figures, the state increases and the national trend during that period.
Is that correct?
And since you have a reserve already, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Brinkman?
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman. Yes, ma'am.
And Mr. Brinkman, do you insure a number of school districts in the area?
Mr. Brinkman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sikora, in northeastern Minnesota, we have a self-insured school pool and a self-insured city, county, other governmental pool. On the school pool side, we currently insure 29 of the 33 public school systems in our service area.
Representative Sikora?
One last question. So since you already have a reserve established, is your insurance now cheaper because you already have that reserve?
Mr. Brinkman?
I mean, can you keep your premiums lower because you already have a reserve established? Because here we're talking about building a whole new pool of reserves.
Mr. Brinkman?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Sikora, our reserves and the fact that we're already in business, yes, does allow us the pooling effect highlighted by testimony earlier of proponents of the bill and in the study as an option going forward is already part of what we do. So the answer is yes.
Representative Sikora?
And then one last thing. Can you be competitive with whatever the statewide plan is saying that it will do?
Mr. Brinkman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sikora, if voluntary, yes, and we would love to do that. We're currently competing with the state plans. You've got good people working in the state of Minnesota, but we do compete for business, and we think it works well in the marketplace currently.
Representative Sikora?
Thank you.
Representative Rukubina?
When you talk about a pool, that you have a pool for your school districts and a pool for the county employees, I think, do you have some city employees, too, or just county?
Mr. Brinkman?
Chairman, Representative Rukavina, we have city, counties, and other governmentals. So we have not just your city and county standard, but we would have, like, if it was a public hospital, in the case of Virginia Regional Medical Center, Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency, the CAP agency. So there's other governmental agencies that are also part of that CCOG
so,
pool.
Mr. Rukavina? So, Paul, you have a pool that all the teachers, is this... Are we comparing apples to apples? Does your pool include all the families and their members that are insured by you, whether it's the Hibbing School District, the Virginia School District, the Nashua, if you want, and they're all in the same pool, like Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Brinkman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, aside from the fact that the proposal calls for what appears to be a modified mandatory pool, yes. In other words, we do not have everybody in our region, but we are doing an apples-to-apples comparison of a majority of districts in our region. Yes.
Representative Representative Rufina.
I just wanted to...
Any other Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies. The witness's last answer sparked a need for clarification. My experience in the school district where I teach is that premiums are based on the experience not of the regional group that administers our plan, but of the individual school district. And so when we had a teacher tragically die in an auto accident one morning on the way to school, there was significant health care expenses previous to her death. That had an impact on our rates the next year because it's a fairly small pool, and we had a bad year with a couple of cancers in the auto accident. When you rate the individual school districts, and Representative Rukavina can run off the names better than I, are you costing them out on a district-by-district utilization or as part of your large pool? I think that's the clarification that I need, sir.
Mr. Brinkman?
That's what I thought.
Sorry, Tom. Mr. Chairman, Representative, may I just back up for a moment and hopefully we'll get to the answer. One of the reasons that I found in my service at the co-op that we're able to compete successfully in the marketplace with a product that people are concerned about being able to afford any longer is because we've identified a method that allows us to have the best of a variety of worlds. And let me explain. What is your district, sir?
I teach in the Buffalo School District.
If you're in the pool in Northeast, if Buffalo were in the Northeast pool, Buffalo is rated by an actuary at Blue Cross Blue Shield so that your premium is actuarially sound. That premium is adjusted according to the master agreement we have statewide with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. Furthermore, the final premium may be adjusted with the pooling effect referenced by Mr. Johansson earlier at the regional level. So we have found clean ways to make sure that we've run the right numbers in assessing risk at the local level, applied a statewide solution with a master agreement with Blue Cross Blue Shield, and then modulated it at the regional level to the benefit of that particular region, representing differences among the regions across the state of Minnesota. So when people say, why does this work, Paul? We just run that example for them, and lights go on. They say, okay, I see. You found out where those points are where you can realize savings along the way, and that's part of the reason why we've been able to be so competitive.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. It's been a long day. Your name again, sir?
Paul Brinkman.
Mr. Yes. Brinkman. So to try to put a finer point on it, because I'm at a point where I need diagrams and a cup of coffee. When you factor in the experience of whether it's school districts or the other public agencies that you referred to, that you also service, you are looking, the experience factor is based on the experience of the individual groups, not everyone in the Northeast Service Cooperative. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, as I mentioned, that is part of the equation, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for anybody? Representative Goodwin?
Oh, Mr. Brinkman, did you say earlier in the earlier committee meeting that your increases were 12.9% in the last year?
Mr. Brinkman?
In the co-op, too.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative, we did not mention what our increases were. At the Northeast Service Cooperative, our aggregate regional increase last year, after the application of Blue Cross Blue Shield's master agreement and any pooling effect, was 14.8% in Northeast Minnesota.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you.
Any other questions for members, for anybody? Okay, I would renew my motion that House File 2384, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Educational Policy. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. With that, we have four bills up tomorrow. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.